going here. Thanks to all of our volunteer staff, our chat room moderators, Lottie and Sparky, our blogger, Texas Betsy, our news ninjas, Gene and Susan, Reverbo, our op-ed columnist, my head writer, David, in Tennessee, also my fact checker, and John Fox in Australia, who manages the website and keeps the demons at bay in that regard, and to Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org. 10 million hours served. Is that just mind-boggling? Yeah, that's why I say he literally saved liberal radio on the Internet. And thanks, of course, always to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the folks at...
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here today on the big program. We're going to be talking with Heather Schumacher, community affairs manager with Planned Parenthood. Yes, the dreaded, the evil, the country-destroying Planned Parenthood. You know, those people who take care of all the women that we love and care about. You know, those evil people. And you listen to the right wing just going nuts over this group who, you know, just a very small percent of what they do are abortions. Most of what they do are screening for diseases, screening for breast cancer, just basic gynecological health. But the folks on the extreme right wing, just rabid with hatred. So it'll be interesting to talk to her and see if we can get the inside plans on how they plan to bring down America. Because if you listen to the right wing, man, that's all they're talking about. They're just with them and their contraception. Huh. And the other part of me that goes, you know, these folks on the radical right, most of my rabidly right-wing friends were accidents. So maybe subconsciously they have some self-loathing. That if their parents had an option, if contraception were available to their parents, maybe they wouldn't be here. You know, just something to think about when you look at these really angry people. Because nothing in the Affordable Care Act has anything to do with mandating that people take contraceptions. No, it has to be available. If you want to use it, go ahead. But it's not saying you have to by mandate. We're like the Republicans and a lot of the rabidly right-wing wanted to do to welfare recipients. If you remember that whole push, especially the 80s, it was just when they came out with that Norplant. I don't know if you remember this. When they came out with that Norplant where they shoot that little capsule into your arm or whatever, there were people who said we should be mandating that because, you know, they're just producing children. None of the religious people seem to be really concerned about that. But, boy, if you offer it and it's available, people might use it. And then we can't get any cheap workers. Just nuts. In the second hour, we're going to talk with Julia Ramsey, political director over at Action United, about the foreclosure settlement. Big news of the day. There is an agreement. So we'll talk about that. In the third hour, we're going to talk with Jim Burns, chairman of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party, about the budget, and, well, this sham of a shale tax, just ridiculous. Patrick Gallagher will also be here during the program. He's the sub-director for the United Steelworkers, the spokesperson for bargaining over at Cooper Tire. You know, I guess talks broke down on Tuesday. You know, we've been telling you about this. The United Steelworkers built a case for the Obama administration to take to the WTO against the Chinese who have been just dumping tires into this country. Well, they wanted to destroy the tire industry here. They wanted to take it over. And give them credit. They're smart. If they can destroy our industry, take it for themselves, then we have to buy it from them. So the steelworkers said, no, we should probably fight back, you know, stand up for ourselves, maybe just a little bit. Took the case to the Obama administration. To Obama's credit, took it on to the WTO. Actually won. Good for both of them. And jobs had to come back to the U.S. So, You know, the last guy we talked to came right out and said, look, the plant manager told him that they're going to suffer for the Obama administration mandating that those jobs come back. They're going to pay them back. So what did Cooper Tire do? They locked out their employees at the end of their contract. This is payback time. So we're going to talk to Patrick Gallagher about that and see what we can do to help. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me here, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So the big news, the foreclosure settlement. I now have come up with a number. Evidently, forgery and faking documents now has a fee put to it. I guess it's $2,000. So, and this is what just drives me insane. You know, as I'm looking through all of the numbers and all of the things that are going on for people who fraudulently made up documents and forged those documents to kick people out of their homes, they're going to have to pay $2,000. If you or I did that, there would be a little room for us, generally painted gray, maybe institutional white, you know, something like that, with bars in front of it. We'd be locked up in a 10 by 10 cell. This is a crime, and they're going to get away with it. And this is what always amazed me. You know, we believe in free markets and punishment and iron-fisted rule for you and me, but it's socialism and, well, pat on the back for big business. And this is really what this is, just a little, I'm not even going to say it's a slap on the wrist, because it's really not, because if you look at the numbers, they're talking about $26 billion. But of that $26 billion, the way I'm seeing it, maybe a fifth of it is going to be their money. The rest of it, not so much. And as I'm reading through it, you know, the people who are struggling, you know, everybody who has a mortgage who's underwater and has fallen behind, people who have first loans, I don't know that there's a lot of help there. I guess from the way I'm reading this, there's $20 billion going to be available to shore up second loans. So I guess in this instance, if you're second in line, you're going to be okay. And when we talk to our guest on that later on, this is something I'm going to have to clarify. Maybe Julia Ramsey will know, but I'm looking at this going, so if I've got one mortgage and I'm falling behind, not much help, but if I took out a second one, that's okay? I don't know. And I look at some of the enforcement from what I'm reading, the enforcement mechanism, not so strong. They claim there's some teeth there. I'm not seeing it. And if we look at, you know, some of the past things that have gone on, I don't know that the teeth are there. I don't know that that you're going to keep the cop on the beat all that long. So I don't know. And I go back to this whole thing of the fraud, this robo signing that went on, all of the making up of documents. Are we going to hold mirrors accountable? There's a lot of questions in this. Because at the end of the day, this whole crisis that was brought about because of Graham Leach Bliley, brought about because we decided during the Clinton years and Clinton signed it, but this was pushed through by the Republicans, Phil Graham being the head architect of this. Most people don't even remember Tippy Turtle, but there he was, one of the first people out there pushing this hard to separate, to take away the thing that separated banks who did mortgages and savings accounts and, you know, car loans from gambling houses. There was a clear line there. You couldn't combine them. But when we passed Graham Leach Bliley, when they got the bill passed through and signed in 2000, it was open season. It was fair game, because now they figured out quite simply, we can take this boring bank instrument, this boring, just, you know, not all that great of short-term profit instrument, and we can bundle them up together, and we can sell them off to long-term investors and make big bank right now. Because understand how Wall Street thinks. Wall Street thinks right now, how much am I going to put in my pocket this very second? Don't care about tomorrow. Don't care about right now. And the big banks, the boring banking people, they're supposed to be thinking long term. So when you took long term thought and you combined it with short term greed right now, who do you think won? Of course, short term greed won. And I go back to one of the listeners who, you know, who was a banker for 30 odd years and said, look, I can remember the day when this thing turned around, the day we started thinking of houses as assets instead of thinking about, can the person who's buying it actually afford it? And he said, look, you know, this is how they explained it. And it was, you know, I guess from a banking point of view, fairly logical. You know, if Rick Smith wants to buy a house for $150,000, even if he's only making $25,000 a year, go ahead, lend it to him. Get him in that house. He's going to put money down. He's going to pay closing costs. He's going to pay fees. He's going to play all that money. They're going to throw it into the mortgage, whatever they're going to do. We're going to be able to collect that short term now. He's got a house that's worth $150,000. And you know what? For 2, 3, 5 years, he's going to be making payments on it every month, like clockwork. He's going to, until he finally falls so far behind that he loses the house. We take that house back, being the banks, we the banks, take it back. We've got a $150,000 asset, and we've got his money back. And here's the thing, $150,000 asset over 4 or 5 years, the way they were projecting it would go up in value. So instead of the $150,000 asset that they had loaned on, they would have a $200,000 asset, and the guy probably had to buy private mortgage insurance, so somebody was picking up the tab. This was a no-lose situation for the big banks until it all came collapsing down. And this idea that somehow, oh, it was that poor working stiff, it was that minority, it was the Community Reinvestment Act that did it. It was Carter that did it by giving those black people loans, had very little to do with it. If those were the only people that the bubble burst on, we would not have felt nary a blow of wind. What we would have felt is nothing. What happened was is we were giving those mid-level executives making $100,000 a year, we were giving them $500,000, $600,000, $700,000 loans. We were giving them big money. And when they lost those jobs, because everything started to unravel, they couldn't pay it anymore. And it was just an explosion. And from there on down, everybody got hurt. And then the smart people who said, you know what, I own this house. Well, actually, the bank owns the house. I've got an interest-only mortgage, which figured that one out. Anybody who's got half a brain is smart enough to realize that that's a mistake. But we were doing it. Here's an interest-free mortgage or an interest-only mortgage. So all I'm paying is interest. I'm not paying any principal, nothing, just the interest. So all those people who go, gee, you know, I bought this house for $500,000. The market's collapsed. It's worth $300,000. I've paid no principal into it. I've got no stake in this game. There's nothing here for me. I'm going to leave the keys in the door, and I'm heading on down the road. That's what happens when, and this is where the righties are right on one vein. You got to have some stake in the game. You got to have some skin there. And we had so many people who were able to take out loans, 125% of the value of the home they were able to take out loans for. That is a system that is just screaming to collapse. But somehow it's the poor black people's fault. So we're going to find out about this deal, some other things we'll be talking about today. The shale tax, the lost opportunity by the Corbett administration to invest, the war on religion, because, you know, they're coming for you, and the war on women. Quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Where common sense, reason, and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to Win Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The IBEW Local 1464 organizing win at a GE transportation plant in Kansas City, Missouri, the first at a GE plant in 10 years, was officially certified this week. GE mounted a strong anti-union campaign through its union avoidance operation, but IBEW lead organizer Mike Knox says workers at the plant got fed up with broken management promises and wanted union representation. He says this organizing win for the IBEW sends a powerful message.
It was a very big win. Our message is, you bring the IBEW in, you now have a seat at the table. Before, you take what the company gives you. Company doesn't give you a raise. Company changes your benefits. What do? You can't do anything. You have to take what the company gives you. You bring the IBEW in. Now you have a seat at the table. You have a say-so. You can vote on what goes in that contract.
A worker was killed at that plant in 2010. IBEW 1464 business manager Daryl McCubbins says despite a constant anti-union campaign by GE, the workers who rebuild railroad traction motors at the plant voted for the IBEW. McCubbins says safety was a huge issue, and he urges workers facing similar issues to contact local unions and get organized.
If you're in a place that you would like to see organized, contact a local in your area and sit down and get informed of what your rights are and start having conversations with other coworkers. I believe the labor movement is on the upswing, and we're still here, but we need help to get to the people to help organize them.
Republicans are not happy about having their National Labor Relations Board obstructionism trumped by President Obama. Jesse Russell has more.
Republicans spent Tuesday fretting that President Barack Obama's recess appointments to the National Labor Relations Board amounted to a constitutional crisis. Committee on Education and the Workforce Chairman John Klein of Minnesota argued that businesses will be unable to make important decisions because they aren't clear on the legitimacy of the appointments. Republicans had been opposed to approving the president's picks, leaving the board incomplete and in violation of the National Labor Relations Act. During a Tuesday hearing, Arizona Representative Raul Grijalva said an incomplete labor board was hurting working families.
Employers, not to mention the workers and their families, I don't think they benefit from a dysfunctional board that cannot make decisions. That to me is even routine, mundane decisions can't be made during this period. And that to me seems to be really bad public policy.
This newscast made possible in part by Ulico, the Union Labor Life Insurance Company. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Absence works. Maybe it's the way it's being taught or the way that it's being applied out there. But the fact of the matter is, it is the best form of to teach our children.
Smith Show. He would have made such a good president, don't you think? Oh, Rick Perry. Because it doesn't, you know, maybe it's just we're not teaching it right or we're not doing it right. But abstinence, according to him, works. And it does, because we're not evidently teaching it right or applying it right. What a nitwit. Anyway, today I was reading in USA Today, which I've been talking about this for probably 6 years now. This move back towards undoing Griswold has been going on for quite some time. It's just now they feel really emboldened to come out and scream and holler and carry on. This general counsel for the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, this guy Anthony Piccirillo, he was quoted in USA Today saying there's a lot of talk in the last couple of days about compromise, about contraception. He says, but it sounds to us like they're trying to turn down the heat to placate people without any doing anything in particular. He said, we're not going to do anything until this is fixed. He says this means removing the provision from the health care law altogether. He said, not simply changing it for Catholic employers and their insurers. And, you know, here's the thing. You know, understand, this is what they want. They want it completely ripped out of there. And my question on it is nobody forces him to take it, do they? I mean, he goes on to say, if I quit my job and open up a Taco Bell, he'd be covered by the mandate. But nobody would mandate that he take it.
That's just very strange. But here to help answer a couple of those questions and some other things around the issue, Heather Schumacher, Community Affairs Manager with the dreaded Planned Parenthood. Heather, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you for having me.
Let's get this straight right from the beginning. I understand you personally are the people who are trying to destroy this nation and rip the soul and the heart out of our conscience.
It would seem that way, wouldn't it?
You know, heaven forbid that we have women who have access to gynecological care, to breast exams, to contraception. Heaven forbid that we have that.
Well, you know, and 99% of women who are sexually active take birth control. So obviously, you know, the other side isn't doing that good of a job.
You know, I actually have a theory, and I came up with it in the opening. The theory is, and the people who are rabidly against it, people like Rick Santorum, there's part of me that looks at him and goes, you know, I think he believes he was an accident and his parents didn't really want him, and that if they had access to birth control, he wouldn't be here today.
That is an interesting theory. It might be. You never know.
But you're not going there with me.
That'll just add fuel to the fire is what that would do.
But here's the thing. I mean, I read a headline today that said members of Congress benefit from contraception coverage. But now they seek to limit access for women. And I said, of course, because they're mostly men, rich men at that.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And the fact is 99% of women are already using birth control, and even the Institute of Medicine has said that it's a health benefit. So I don't even, it doesn't seem like an issue, like it should be an issue, right?
To me, it isn't an issue. I mean, the issue should be that I would be upset if someone didn't have access. This is actually the right wing of this country putting government between me and my insurance company, or me and my doctor or my employer, by them wanting to say that they can't offer it. That, to me, seems insane. I'm curious your thoughts.
Yeah, I would have to agree. I mean, I think that their argument that this is an intrusion of their right to practice their religion is just, it's very ironic, because, you know, if they had it their way, then all their employees, regardless of what religion they are, you know, there's all sorts of religions, all sorts of people who are employed by Catholic universities and hospitals and other institutions. And if they had it their way, those people wouldn't be allowed to access, you know, the health care that they choose to use, which is really an intrusion on their right to practice whatever sort of health care, religious benefits they'd like to do.
Yeah, my grandfather always said, you've got the right to do whatever it is you want to do until
exactly.
your right steps on my right.
Exactly.
And in looking at this, you know, as an employer myself, you know, I'm going to give the care, the health care that's available, that's, you know, that's the best cost. But, you know, you want your employees to have what it is that best for them. I don't know that as an employer, I should have the right to dictate what treatment you get. And this seems to me to be the Catholic Church saying, we as an institution, as an employer, want to be able to dictate what type of care you get. It seems to me to be, well, flying in the face of logic and law.
Exactly, and I think that you hear it. You hear the exact opposite being said on the other side. You know, this benefit, it's not going to force anyone to take birth control. It's not going to force them to provide themselves. They're not going to be forced to provide the birth control. It's, you know, it's one step away from that. It's about health insurance coverage. I mean, it's their side is really ignoring. Just completely ignoring the religious freedom of their individual workers. You know, they have their own right to make their healthcare decisions, and it shouldn't have anything to do with where you're employed.
Yeah, but we know you people over at Planned Parenthood. You're evil, and I know that you'll hold people down and you'll shove that stuff in their mouth. I know it. No,
you would think so, right? I mean,
that's the tone that I'm getting. That's what I you know, look. All of the rhetoric I hear from the right, that's what it sounds like, that you guys, you know, sit in your secret little den and go, how can we give birth control to people and force them into abortions, which seems at the opposites to me. Saying, hey, take birth control so you don't have to have an abortion if something happens seems to be logical, no?
It seems to be very logical to us, too. You know, it's over 95% of what we do is preventative. You know, I also in the news has been a lot of the Susan G. Komen, you know, and there's been there's been kind of lies about Planned Parenthood and similar organizations from a lot of different groups. But the reality is that we provide 750,000 clinical breast exams every year. You know, that 95% of what we do is annual appointments, STD screenings, birth control, breast exams. You know, we're not the monsters that we're made out to be sometimes.
Yeah, and, you know, here's the thing. I mean, in the state of Pennsylvania, I was told that, you know, gynecologists in this state are evidently fleeing. I don't know why. They keep claiming because of malpractice coverage. But, you know, I'm saying, you know, don't we want to help organizations like yours so that, you know, women of low income, especially of low income, who are not going to have the kind of insurance that would help people get coverage either way, that it should be there for folks?
Exactly. And, I mean, there's a large portion of the population that needs service. You know, here I can speak for the Planned Parenthood within kind of Northeast and Mid-Pennsylvania, but we see a huge number of women and men that are below the poverty level. And, I mean, with the birth control, the access to having no copay birth control, these are exactly the types of things we need to have, you know, to plan your pregnancy, prevent pregnancy if you wish, and not to mention that, you know, many different groups, including the Institute of Medicine, have recognized birth control as a health benefit. I don't know why we wouldn't want to support that.
Yeah, I don't either. And, you know, for all the people who are rabidly anti-abortion, wouldn't prevention be the best way to stop abortion?
Absolutely. And that's exactly what we think. And we hear a lot of arguments out there that this benefit under the Affordable Care Act pays for abortions, and I just want to put it out there that that's absolutely false. The benefit does not cover abortion. It just requires the health plan cover FDA-approved prescription contraception, not abortion.
Right.
So,
but you know,
put that out there.
But why muddle the issue with facts?
I know, right? It's too difficult, I guess.
Listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Heather Schumacher. She is Community Affairs Manager with Planned Parenthood of Northeast and Mid-Pennsylvania. You know, I'm looking at this, and the first thought that pops into my head is, are there any First Amendment violations here? Is there anything giving religious organizations the ability to say, I'm not going to follow the law? Is there anything interpreting that says, you know what, I employ somebody, so I shouldn't be covered by certain laws? Anything like that that you know of?
There is. We do have a New York State Supreme Court case that has looked at just that, and they've said that the sort of benefit doesn't violate the First Amendment because and it doesn't burden one's religious belief or practice. And I do have a quote if you'd like to hear it. That
sure.
Hit me with it. Summarizes it perfectly. When a religious organization chooses to hire non-believers, it must, at least some degree, be prepared to accept neutral regulations imposed to protect those employees' legitimate interests in doing what their own beliefs permit. And I think that really gets to the point that, you know, we're only hearing about religious freedom and the First Amendment rights of, you know, the Catholic Church as a whole, but we're completely, you know, we don't hear about the individual rights of the individual workers. And I think that's what I think is very important. They should have their own right to make their own healthcare decisions. And
absolutely.
Their employer should not be involved in that at all.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing with me is if this were a First Amendment or religious issue, if you were saying you have to take it, I'm going to ram it down your throat, then yeah, I'm with you. I don't want to force anyone to have to take anything. But if I remember right, going back to the 90s, and I don't know how old you are if you remember this, but there was a right-wing movement in this country to get welfare recipients in order to get benefits, to have to have that Norplant that they would shoot into your arm in order to get benefits. And I would go, well, you know, isn't there some type of religious exemption then? And I didn't hear the religious people going crazy about that.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. Not surprised.
Sure.
I would think that sounds more like a lot more of a problem than the birth control situation we have right now.
So let me ask, let's go back to the Susan G. Komen for the Cure debacle. The woman who was the founder of it, this Nancy Brinker, she came out today, said she kind of mishandled the situation. I guess her first public statement in quite some time. Made some mistakes, learned some lessons. How much of this do you think is, you know, like her fault or the political right wingers that she brought along, like the like Ari Fleischer and the other woman?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I can't really, I'm not sure of what is necessarily her fault, but I do think that we did enjoy our partnership with the Komen Foundation, and we look forward to potentially working with them in the future. But we were saddened to see that they had, you know, succumbed to political pressure. We do think there was a political pressure there to end their partnership with us. It's kind of difficult to know exactly, you know, what happened behind the scenes, but we do think there was some political pressure there.
Yeah, sure. The one thing that they have surely done is, I will not be doing anything with them for the foreseeable future, and my wife is very unhappy, who was a big fan of theirs. In fact, my wife, I call the breast Nazi or a lactivist. You know, she is someone who, you know, would go out of her way to help them, and now she's really, really fumed. And she's not someone who's political, because I'm political enough for the both of us.
Well, you know, and it actually turned out, a difficult situation, I think, turned out really well for the women of the United States, at least, which is exactly who we want to benefit. We raised the Planned Parenthood between the time when the decision first came out that they weren't going to partner with us anymore and when they reversed their decision. That couple of days, we raised $3 million, which is 5 times more than what we would have received with their grant. So all of that money that we get, every single cent, is going to go to breast health in the United States. So, I mean, I think it's, for us, it's a win-win situation because we wanted to help women prevent breast cancer and you know, detect it early, and that's what we're going to be able to serve more people. So.
Outstanding. And maybe you should send them a thank you card.
I know, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Last question I've got for you. You know, we hear this. The Catholics are saying, well, we shouldn't have to be mandated because we're our own business and we have all this nonsense. But aren't they taking lots of federal money and all of the deductions we give them and all of the write-offs that they get? Isn't that a lot of federal money as well? So couldn't we say that, you know, they're not so much a religious group as, you know, just another employer?
Yeah, I guess that's, we kind of see it in that way. And there is actually an expansive refusal exemption within the law as it is, and that allows like about 335,000 churches and houses of worship to not have to provide birth control coverage for employees. So that's already in place, and that's not going to change. But, you know, the religious hospitals and universities that operate as a business and serve and employ the broader public, we think they need to follow the same rules everybody else follows. And, you know, like you said, with federal dollars, they need to provide the same benefits that the rest of the world has to provide.
I am right there with you, and I hope this doesn't go away. I hope we fight this back, because the righties have got the time, the money, and the megaphone. I was listening to all the media outlets today are just railing, and we're seeing a couple of Democrats breaking ranks. It's sad.
Absolutely. And, you know, if people are interested in this, there's going to be a press conference on the Capitol Rotunda tomorrow at noon. So we'd love to see you all there.
Outstanding. Well, we will make sure that we get someone over there to get us a report.
Excellent.
Heather Schumacher, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Heather Schumacher, Community Affairs Manager at the dreaded, the evil, the Planned Parenthood. Back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Save the USA, drowning in crafty lies. Save the USA and resume the ties of mine. Stop taking all our money and shipping it onshore. Do the job, join the people.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Last year, during an intimate chat-and-chew dinner with some Silicon Valley high-tech barons, President Barack Obama posed a question to Steve Jobs, baron of the Apple Empire. What would it take to make iPhones in the United States? Good question. We need to put more people to work building more stuff in America, rather than shipping all that manufacturing off to China. Instead of answering, however, Jobs just said, "Those jobs aren't coming back." Well, why not? Why shouldn't American corporations go all out to help meet the obvious economic needs of the nation that nurtures them? The high-techers don't mention the obvious reasons for their jobs dodge, raw corporate selfishness. Rather than looking inward, however, they blame America. First, they wail that American schools are failing to produce the high-skilled workers they need, so they must go abroad. Yet, these very executives constantly demand that governments exempt them from paying the taxes necessary to improve schools. Second, they say that the U.S. lacks an integrated supply chain, which would locate makers of assorted computer parts right next door to assembly plants. But wait, that's their fault. Apple, Dell, and the like have the market clout to entice suppliers to relocate anywhere in America. Indeed, U.S. suppliers say they've had to move to China because that's where Apple et al. Went. Finally, industry leaders blame us, their customers. They assert that we insist on getting a new cheap iGadget every year, no matter where it's made or how workers are treated, so we force them to abandon America. This is Jim Hightower saying, hogwash! These self-serving, over-pampered, high-tech elites can make iPhones and anything else right here in America. But they care more about their bottom lines than their country or their workers. And it's time for us to call them on it.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get paid too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again. Because God is a
Yes, he's a Republican, and he hates contraception. He hates women. Doesn't want them. Nothing. And I look at this Jim Gerlach, this congressman from the 6th Congressional District here in Pennsylvania, and you gotta love the rhetoric. Again, you know, it's like he cut and pasted from all the other insanity pieces out there. He said he released the following statement today in response to Obama's recently revealed mandate. Recently revealed. Remember, 2009 was a long time ago. Evidently, his memory is kind of short because it was in there then. Yes. In fact, Joe Pitts was out there putting bills out trying to undo all of this back then. So now they're trying to make this a new issue. It's not a new issue. This is a done issue already, and it'll be part of the lawsuit. But he goes, you know, no, religious-affiliated hospitals, universities, and organizations have to cover sterilization, birth control, and abortion-inducing drugs. I have to give him credit. I do have to give him credit there. He didn't say abortion. Because the righties keep saying that, well, you know, he's paying for abortions. It's not. What the real argument is, if they're going to be honest, is Plan B, they claim, is an abortion pill. And that's what they used to call it. That's what they're saying while making this prescription available. That's what they're going after. Personally, I think it's completely ridiculous, especially when you look at the polling numbers. Catholics are okay with it. In fact, the polling number I saw put Catholics wanting it in their health care way, way up. In the over 70% range. Who is it? It's a handful. And again, we talk about being part of a democracy. Let's talk about having it be part of a democracy. The righties think that this is an issue that's going to rile their base. That's going to get the insaniacs out all lathered up and all wadded up in the panties. And maybe it will. All the while, you and I get screwed. I mean, you look at that State of the Union address the other day. Or, I mean, the State of the State address by Corbett the other day. We talk about being a Christian nation. We're so concerned about what the Catholics think. Why not, you know, why not, if you're going to be that, you're not going to claim that, why not do it? What we did was really the antithesis of Christianity in that budget. You cut education for kids, you cut health care, you cut assistance for the poor, and you enriched the wealthy.
That's what they did. And in fact, you know, if you remember the governor back in when he was running for office, he had said that, you know, Rendell had had given money for a Arlen Specter library. And that, well, let me play the ad for you.
Ed Rendell says he wants to raise taxes right now, because if I become governor, I won't do it. Well, he's right about that. But how about instead of raising taxes, we cut the wasteful spending we know is there? Like $45 million Harrisburg spent renovating their office building, or $40,000 spent just to move a statue from the governor's mansion. Next time you hear we have to raise taxes because there's nothing else to cut, think about the $10 million for the Arlen Specter Library.
Think about the $10 million for the Arlen Specter Library. Now we find out the governor is giving $2 million more to the Arlen Specter Library. I thought that was wasteful spending. I'm not against funding libraries, but didn't he say he wouldn't? But he sure gave out those tax breaks. He sure made sure that big business was taken care of. Who got hurt, though? Well, the bottom of the economic scale, the poor, the students, the middle class, who now are going to have to dig deeper or take out bigger loans to send their kids to college. And this is this another. You look at this budget, another year of lost opportunities. The choices he made, the choices that the Republicans are going to make when they approve this, are going to be devastating, not only to the state right now, but into the future. I mean, the fact that his own transportation funding advisory commission, his own commission, said we need $2.7 billion. And he has nothing set aside. Oh, we're going to talk about it. We'll hold hearings. Nothing. And we know transportation creates jobs and brings in other employers, because you're going to have a transportation system that we can get products to market. And I look at this and I'm going, well, you know, what's the goal? Is the goal to have a state that employers want to come to because we have a good infrastructure, a good education system, a good framework, good people, good place for business? Or is it about taxes only? Is it how low can we go? I mean, all this talk he made about tough choices rings kind of hollow to me. And, you know, you look at all these tough choices he makes, they seem to only affect people who are basically powerless to fight back. I mean, how many kids are going to be able to take on the governor? How many poor families are going to be able to stand up and fight back? How many working class families who have got their nose at the grindstone, busting their behinds to try and get the kid to go to college? Who do they got to fight for? All they seem to care about is, well, all they seem to care about is what the lobbyists want, what the gas industry wants, what the for-profit charter schools want. I mean, you look at these block grants. Oh, innovation. We're going to have block grants. We've seen that movie time and time again, and it's failed every single time. They stripped 150,000 people off of health care. Was that good for the state? No, it's probably going to cost me more in the long run because we don't have the investment idea anymore. We don't have the thought process that goes on, if I don't fix something today, it's going to get worse tomorrow and the day after. And our transportation system is a prime example of that. You know, like I said at the beginning of the week, I was doing some research this week, came across back in the early 80s, they wanted high-speed rail back in the 80s. And we failed to invest then, and I'm telling you, in 20 years or 30 years from now, somebody's going to be doing some research back to the year 2011 and 2012, and they're going to go, oh, gee, they were talking about high-speed rail back then? Wonder why they didn't do anything. Because we're afraid to invest. And this whole earmark ban, which I think is dumb. I think if you do it right, earmarks are a good thing. But we've, again, like a lot of words, they've beaten it up. They've demonized it. And you got Toomey, our senator, along with Claire McCaskill, a Democrat, who want a permanent ban on earmarks, which means that if you see something in your community that's broken or something that needs to be fixed or cities that need upgrades or whatever, there isn't a mechanism in place to get that done quickly. Now, look, has it gotten out of hand? Sure. And that's where you have to have some oversight. Again, it's called regulation. It's called somebody watching out, something the Republicans are hell-bent against. But the reality is you got Republicans right now who are looking at this earmark thing going, we got stuff in our districts need to be done, not getting done. Jeff Sessions, the guy who said, you know, what we're doing is we're conceding all our power to the, to the president. We don't want to do that because we'd like to build our own stuff. But the right, the really extreme part of the party, they hell bent on. We're not going to let government spend anything. We're not going to let government make people's lives at all better. And that's what it's really about for them. That's what it's really about. When we come back, we'll talk about their popularity and how well they've been doing on saying, hey, look at what a great job we're doing. Especially now that people are seeing things crumbling under their feet. Quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Thursday, February 9th, Mars is less than 1 month away from its March 3rd opposition, when it'll be at its best for this two-year period. Let the moon show you Mars tonight.
On the night of February 9th, 2012, the moon, planet Mars, and the constellation Leo the Lion are seen together over the eastern horizon about 2 to 3 hours after sunset. Regulus, Leo's brightest star, rises first at nightfall or early evening. Then the Moon and Mars follow some 60 to 90 minutes later.
The fainter stars of Leo might be hard to make out in the lunar glare tonight, but Regulus is Leo's brightest star and one of the brightest stars in our night sky. It'll be easy to spot. Mars beams even more brilliantly than Regulus. You can find Mars now near Denebola, the star that depicts the lion's tail.
Mars is a planet and moves in front of the background of stars. It makes a beeline around the entire sky through all the constellations of the zodiac every 2 years.
Leo's stars, like all stars, are much more steadfast. They rise 4 minutes earlier each day, or 2 hours earlier with each passing month. In March 2012, watch for Mars in front of Leo as soon as darkness falls.
We have lots more on Mars at the Tonight page at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind? 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425, or check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can go to the website and download the podcast, or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app, and you can take the program on the go. So, you know, you look at the fact that Congress's approval rating, right now the lowest it's ever been, 10% of those people surveyed by Gallup approve of Congress's job performance, according to the released results yesterday. And look, it was across the board. Democrats gave them 11% approval, Republicans a 12% approval, and independents 8%. In all, you look at this and you go, it can't be good. cannot be good for those up for re-election, especially in the House, and the, well, what, the 23 Republicans up in the Senate, and the 10 Democrats up in the Senate. Not good times. But look, this is of their doing. People look where they live. And if you see your neighborhood crumbling, you see problems that aren't being addressed, you see the results of complete inactivity by our Congress. And this has really been the game plan all along, is to make the institution completely ineffective. And to make sure that we give away all of the resource that was coming in, because, you know, as Grover Norquist said,
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
And you listen to that and you go, what have they done? Well, exactly that. We've had to go begging to borrow money to keep up with the things that we need to get done. And the numbers are not surprising. 10% actually seems kind of high to me. You know, you look at all the fights that we've had. Go back to the debt debacle, to the debt ceiling debacle, which actually ended up costing us tons of money because the world said, these guys can't come to an agreement. They're not going to be able to solve their problems. Our debt rating went down, which meant we're going to have to pay a little bit more in interest. Now, understand, the interest rate is very low, but still, even a little bump when you're talking about that kind of big numbers is a lot of money. And now you look at the fight that's going on now. Again, how long do we have to have this debate on, are we going to help middle-class families with this payroll tax deduction, with this break, or the unemployment numbers? You know, making sure that folks who are unemployed get some help, get some job training, get some assistance. You know, this, you're on your own, brother, isn't working. And this, you know, and it's really the Republicans who have taken this mentality, this let's take it to the edge, let's go all the way, you know, just before we fall off the edge of the cliff and see what we can wring out of the Democrats. And Democrats cave. That's what they've been doing. Go back issue after issue. You like to call it compromise. It's not compromise. It's being held hostage. You know, if someone on the street sticks a gun in my face and says, give me all your money, and I say, how about if I only give you half? Is that compromise? I didn't want to give him any of my money. Well, this is what they understand, and they're good at it. They're thugs. And you look at this Stock Act. I mean, here's something that should be a no-brainer, and they should make a big production out of, we're going to make sure that what is already illegal is still illegal. And what is already illegal and has always been illegal is now something we catch, is now something we enforce, is now something we have strong oversight over so that you can have some faith in us. And what do we see? Yeah, we see Eric Cantor and his clan trying to neuter it. Now, understand, it passed today and overwhelmingly, I think it was 417-2. But what'd they do? The House stripped out the one part of it that would give it any real teeth, which is to you know, clarify language on this political intelligence that they have, which is basically buying stock off of what people are following going through Congress, because it's out there. What bills are going? Where is it in the process? When do you think it's going to pass? So we can time when it passes to when we buy or sell or do whatever, because It's gonna one way or another influence the price. So it passed today, and Nancy Pelosi says, you know, well, don't interpret the vote as a seal of approval. Well, if it's not a seal of approval, then why'd you vote for it? I understand the idea of let's get it through, get it into the committee, and get it marked up and go from there, but take a stand. My favorite response to this, Representative Dan Lundgren, Republican from California, he said that, you gotta love it, that evidently lobbying is a constitutional right. So he's not quite sure how you balance the demand for transparency with the constitutional right of people to lobby their government. Claiming it's constitutionally protected activity. And yeah, going to your government for redress of grievances absolutely is. I'm not quite sure that the founders ever envisioned people going and talking for massive groups with large bank accounts and huge checks to buy your allegiance. I'm not quite sure about that. Might have to check into it. Maybe it's in one of the Anti-Federalist papers. Maybe it was part of something I didn't read that day. But at the end of the day, Republican from Georgia, Rob Woodall, I think said it best. Said, look, it's illegal. And it's a disservice to Congress to act as if the current legal status is that for members to be able to use information to buy stock. And I think he's right. He also went on to say the Stock Act has been characterized as to prevent insider trading by members of Congress, as if members of Congress are allowed to participate in insider trading today, and they are not. But here's the thing. We have seen case after case of it happening, which is why you need to have strong oversight. Like the guy we talked to yesterday said, the Ethics Committee does not have a very strong record of oversight. They don't have a very strong record of being the cop on the beat. And, you know, personally, I think that, you know, this is one of those situations where, you know, you vote for rich people because the only people who can run for office are the very well-to-do, because it takes so much money, takes so many connections. Is it surprising that they're accustomed to using that kind of information? And I'm really not surprised. And I don't think it's anything that's new. I think it's been something that's gone on since the beginning of both the stock market and Congress's ability to use that information. It's just now I think we're really, it's front and center. You look at the 24-hour news cycle. You look at all the people who are looking into this. And I think it's good that we have this kind of spotlight. But we also need to make sure that we're holding people accountable. And we have cops on the beat, and we have consequences. And that consequence should be voting people out. No term limits. I'm so tired of talking about term limits. People go, oh, we need term limits. We got term limits. It's called right to go to the ballot box and vote the bums out. Pretty simple. Anyway, when we come back in the next segment, we're going to talk with Julia Ramsey, political director of Action United, on the foreclosure settlement. I'll tell you what my initial reaction to this is. My initial reaction to this is anytime the banking industry is willing to sign anything, anytime they're willing to say, okay, yeah, we'll go along with that, I don't know that it's good for me. I don't know that it's good for you. I don't know that it's good for society. But you know they've entered into this agreement, so it'll be interesting to see how this plays itself out. My favorite part of this whole thing, and you know you gotta love it because 49 of the 50 states have agreed to do it. They've agreed that yeah, this is what we need. This will help help with the problem, help bring our people up. So you know, do it all this stuff. My favorite state number 50, who decided that they wanted to stay out of it. Oklahoma wanted out of it. Not because they thought they could do better on their own, not because they thought that, well, we're gonna hold them more accountable. No. Their state's attorney general, a guy named Scott Pruitt, he didn't think the banks did anything wrong. And they shouldn't have to face any penalty because that's just a free market, see? You rolled the dice, you lost. And since you lost and you pulled all those millions of people down with you and destroyed the housing market and all, you know, 300 million, how many, 150 million households in this country end up losing, that's okay. But according to him, no penalties. Let's take a quick break right back after this with Julia Ramsey, political director at Action United. Stick around right back after this.
Me. I ain't never been on welfare, and that's one place I won't be. I'll be working as long as my two hands are fit to use. I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The IBEW Local 1464 organizing WIN at a GE transportation plant in Kansas City, Missouri, the first at a GE plant in 10 years, was officially certified this week. GE mounted a strong anti-union campaign through its union avoidance operation, but IBEW lead organizer Mike Knox says workers at the plant got fed up with broken management promises and wanted union representation. He says this organizing win for the IBEW sends a powerful message.
It was a very big win. Our message is, you bring the IBEW in, you now have a seat at the table. Before, you take what the company gives you. Company doesn't give you a raise. Company changes your benefits. What do? You can't do anything. You have to take what the company gives you. You bring the IBEW in. Now you have a seat at the table. You have a say, so you can vote on what goes in that contract.
A worker was killed at that plant in 2010. IBEW 1464 business manager Daryl McCubbins says despite a constant anti-union campaign by GE, the workers who rebuild railroad traction motors at the plant voted for the IBEW. McCubbins says safety was a huge issue, and he urges workers facing similar issues to contact local unions and get organized.
If you're in a place that you would like to see organized, contact a local in your area. And sit down and get informed of what your rights are and start having conversations with other coworkers. I believe the labor movement is on the upswing, and we're still here, but we need help to get to the people to help organize them.
Republicans are not happy about having their National Labor Relations Board obstructionism trumped by President Obama. Jesse Russell has more.
Republicans spent Tuesday fretting that President Barack Obama's recess appointments to the National Labor Relations Board amounted to a constitutional crisis. Committee on Education and the Workforce Chairman John Klein of Minnesota argued that businesses will be unable to make important decisions because they aren't clear on the legitimacy of the appointments. Republicans had been opposed to approving the president's picks, leaving the board incomplete and in violation of the National Labor Relations Act. During a Tuesday hearing, Arizona Representative Raul Grijalva said an incomplete labor board was hurting working families.
Employers, not to mention the workers and their families, I don't think they benefit from a dysfunctional board that cannot make decisions. That to me is even routine, mundane decisions can't be made during this period. And that to me seems to be really bad public policy.
This newscast made possible in part by Ulico, the Union Labor Life Insurance Company. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. I got an email during the break pointing out that Rick Santorum was on the stump. And the article I got was from the Colorado Independent. Evidently, you got to love the revisionist history being played out by Mr. Santorum and his sweater vest. He's now blaming the recession. Not on the subprime mortgage crisis. No, that wasn't it. It wasn't on derivatives. It wasn't on any of that stuff. It was on gas prices. He said we went into recession in 2008 and people forgot why. They thought it was the housing bubble. The housing bubble was caused because of a dramatic spike in energy prices. He went on to say that people, you know, they were buying gas for their cars and paying for air conditioning, so they couldn't pay their mortgage. I guess if you're going to revise, that's almost as good as it was the black people who did it. Anyway, there's a settlement, and as I said, I'm extremely cautious of anything the banks are willing to sign. Now I'm even more cautious. Scott Walker, Wisconsin governor, is now all for it. Enthusiastic thumbs up. Now I don't know that I'm really, really interested in this, but that's why I've asked Julia Ramsey, political director at Action United, to come talk to us about the settlement, what it means, where we go. Julia, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you for having me on the show, Rick.
So right from the start, this is a good deal or a bad deal?
It's a mixed bag. I think that's probably the best way to think about it. You know, I think that we have been working on the campaign for a fair settlement for the past few months here in Pennsylvania, along with some other folks in other states across the nation. And I think the original deal that was on the table, the thing that alarmed us the most was that there would be immunity from investigation, from civil lawsuits, from prosecution, and that is not in this deal. So that's actually a big victory.
That's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, you know, states like New York and California have already begun investigating these banks and will be prosecuting. And there are some states where the attorney generals are suing banks for lost pensions, for instance, from unions. So there's a lot that can be done with this settlement.
So it doesn't completely shut the doors, because one of the thoughts I had is, you know, you look at these mirror suits that are going on. I think Schneiderman has one in New York, and I'm not sure where Biden in Delaware or Coakley in Massachusetts is, where they are with these. But, you know, I don't want them getting off the hook scot-free.
Oh, no. They shouldn't, right? I mean, they destroyed our economy. And, you know, I think what's alarming is that the housing crisis happened 4 years ago at this point, and there hasn't been a real investigation at all into the practices of the mortgage industry or the banks. And this is our first big step. You know, it's a few years too late, absolutely, but it's starting now, and, you know, I'm urging our attorney general to jump on that and start investigating the banks and the practices here in Pennsylvania. The homeowners of Pennsylvania, those who are underwater, those who have been foreclosed on, deserve it. And all of us deserve it because the housing crisis brought down our economy.
Yeah, I mean, if I steal a candy bar from the local 7-Eleven or local convenience store, they lock me up. But, you know, the people who took trillions of dollars in assets away from folks across this country, they're still living in their plush hotels and plush suites, living in their gated communities, flying on their private jets on their private islands. I don't see them. They've had much of accountability or consequence or anything.
Oh no, they haven't at all. You know, we've paid for it. You know, homeowners have paid for it. And they've been the ones who suffered the most. But you know, state and municipal governments have paid for it. Private pension funds have paid for it. A lot of people lost a lot of money when the economic crisis happened, and the banks got bailed out, right? But the rest of us are still trying to get back to where we were 4 years ago, and it's a pretty steep hill at this point. So I think that, you know, fully investigating, you know, people should start filing civil lawsuits against these banks for all the money that they've lost. There's so many more ways that we can take this settlement and make much more out of it than what it is right now.
I hope that happens. You know, I'm looking at this, and, you know, I'm thinking back to the tobacco settlements. Mm-hmm. You know, $26 billion sounds like a lot of money, but when you start divvying it up among 49 states and you start divvying it up amongst all the people who got screwed in this, $26 billion doesn't go very far, especially, as I understand it, maybe you've got better numbers than I do, that only about $5 billion of it actually comes from the bank right now. So I'm looking at the two things. I'm looking at the $26 billion seems like a lot, but if I remember right, the tobacco settlements were in the a couple hundred billion.
Yeah, it was $250 billion for the tobacco settlements. And, you know, I think that when I said it's a mixed bag, I think that this point that we have is in the actual number of the settlement. $26 billion, you know, it depends on your estimations. There could be a little bit more money. Certainly not the $200-300 billion that we would have liked to seen out of it.
Right.
So, you know, we're certainly not happy with how much the settlement has come out to be.
But that's probably what you were going to get.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's. But at the same time, states can start to now have individual settlements, right? And private, you know, pension funds or, you know, homeowners can join together and sue banks. And, you know, this could become much more money than it is right now. It really is a first step.
And it should be. And it should be much more. I got to be honest with you right from the start, though, and maybe you can allay some of my fears, because I'm looking at this thing for the fabricating of documents, forging of documents, fraudulent, in my opinion, $2,000 per act. And I think about myself, if I write a bad check or I do something, I'm in jail. Is now $2,000 the penalty for fraud or, you know, making up documents or fraudulently signing things? Because that's basically what we're letting them get away with.
Well, I think it's tremendously disappointing for the 137,000 households in Pennsylvania that have been through foreclosure. $2,000 is not enough if your mortgage is underwater by $50,000. It is some money right now. There's going to be more opportunities for refinancing to reduce your principal. So it's not just $2,000, but it's certainly, again, it's not the size and scope of the settlement that we were looking forward to.
Right.
That's why, you know, we really urge our attorney general, she should be investigating too. I mean, you know, it's time for every state to stand up and do what's right and investigate the banks for what they've done to each of us.
I got to tell you, though, I'm not thinking that's going to happen. Our governor has led us down the path of we need to be more business friendly. And I'm surprised that Pennsylvania signed on and didn't go the way of Oklahoma with their attorney general, who said the banks shouldn't be penalized at all.
Right. Well, you know, it's sort of amazing that she was never available for comment before. But you know, now that it's happened, of course they're going to take money, right? I mean, the only state that isn't going to take the money is Oklahoma. But you know, she's not seeking re-election, right? She was appointed to fill in the term,
right?
And we are going to have a new attorney general next year, so you know, we should really start questioning each one of the candidates who are running. What are they going to do to investigate the banks? What are they going to do, the right and wrongs that the banks have done to Pennsylvania homeowners and to Pennsylvania across the state? And that should be the issue in that race. You know, this is going to be the number three race on the ticket, the president, our U.S. senator, and then our state attorney general.
Yep, absolutely.
They need to be held to that. They need to answer that question. And you know, they need to become champions. You know, in an ideal world, every candidate who's running for attorney general will be running on the platform of investigating banks and prosecuting them for the fraudulent acts that they've done.
Well, get my vote. I said from the beginning, right when this happened back in September of 2008, when we saw all of the things come crumbling down around us, I said I want to see perp walks every day. I want it on the 6 o'clock news and double on the 11 o'clock news. And we just haven't seen that. So then my question becomes, you know, you look at this deal that we're engaging in, is there going to be any enforcement? I mean, if you look at the history of some of these agreements, the compliance has been a little shaky.
Well, you know, the one thing that really gives me some hope that there will be some enforcement is, you know, I've been working closely with Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, his office. And he's been named to this task force as the co-chair. And, you know, I think that it's been 100% his goal to, you know, completely investigate banks. To, you know, this is what he wants. So that gives me hope that he is part of this. So I guess we'll have to see, right?
Do you have any insight into why at the last minute the other day he kind of backed out? I mean, was there something in particular that he wanted that to get in that may have gotten in to get him to sign on to this? Because I remember he called a press conference and at the last second canceled it because I thought he was gonna endorse it the other day.
Yeah, you know, I don't have insight info other than that he really wanted the ability to investigate. He did not want the immunity, and the immunity was always sort of the first and foremost thing in his mind, that the settlement could not have immunity for the banks, that $25 billion was not enough to give away, you know, all forms of civil litigation and prosecution of banks. So I think that when all of that immunity was taken out of the deal, he was satisfied. But, again, I don't have that inside info, just
Well, I mean, if you're telling me it's in there, and there's the ability to go after these people, these robo signers, and hopefully it'll start locking people up. I'm okay with this. But, to me, the bigger problem is what happens. Maybe this is in there, maybe it's not. What happens to all those documents that nobody knows where they are? What happens to the system that's been so screwed up by MERS and DocX and all these other places that maybe we know where the right paperwork is, maybe we don't? Is this covered in there at all?
Well, you know, that I can't answer. just like the math that they've used, it's sort of above my understanding. So I can't really answer that question, what's going to happen to the papers.
That's why I asked you.
To trust that those who are leading these investigations are going to be thorough, and that they're going to have the law in their interest first and foremost.
All right. Julia Ramsey, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much for the information.
Thanks for having me on the show, Rick.
All right. Julia Ramsey, your political director over at Action United. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
I got a picture in my pocket of a lucky one. I'll announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm on till 1 a.m. I must tell you that I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
Last year, during an intimate chat and chew dinner with some Silicon Valley high-tech barons, President Barack Obama posed a question to Steve Jobs, Baron of the Apple Empire. What would it take to make iPhones in the United States? Good question. We need to put more people to work building more stuff in America rather than shipping all that manufacturing off to China. Instead of answering, however, Jobs just said, "Those jobs aren't coming back." Well, why not? Why shouldn't American corporations go all out to help meet the obvious economic needs of the nation that nurtures them? The high-techers don't mention the obvious reasons for their jobs dodge, raw corporate selfishness. Rather than looking inward, however, they blame America. First, they wail that American schools are failing to produce the high-skilled workers they need, so they must go abroad. Yet, these very executives constantly demand that governments exempt them from paying the taxes necessary to improve schools. Second, they say that the U.S. lacks an integrated supply chain, which would locate makers of assorted computer parts right next door to assembly plants. But wait, that's their fault. Apple, Dell, and the like have the market clout to entice suppliers to relocate anywhere in America. Indeed, U.S. suppliers say they've had to move to China because that's where Apple et al. Went. Finally, industry leaders blame us, their customers. They assert that we insist on getting a new cheap iGadget every year, no matter where it's made or how workers are treated, so we force them to abandon America. This is Jim Hightower saying, hogwash! These self-serving, over-pampered, high-tech elites can make iPhones and anything else right here in America. But they care more about their bottom lines than their country or their workers. And it's time for us to call them on it.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
This is cancer. This isn't a sudden crisis that's going to erupt out of the ground like some monster trying to eat us. This is a slow, wasting process.
I kept the promise till the vow got broke. I had to drink from the laughing cup. I stood on the banks till the river rose up. I saw the bride in her wedding gown. I was in the house when the house burned down.
Well, you know, sadly, what we've seen too often is, the house doesn't burn down. People get thrown out of it. What we've got in this country, since 2007, the number that I've seen, somewhere around 4 million people in this country have been foreclosed on in the last 5 years. 4 million families. 4 million families out in the street. And I would wonder how many of them have to do with the fact that they're really screwed over. I mean, it's one thing to take the right-wing view that, well, they should have known what they were signing. It's another thing to say, you know what? We all want that American dream. We all want that house with the picket fence and the yard for the kids to play in and the dog jumping around.
That's what's been sold to us as the American dream. That's the gold standard by which Americans, I think most Americans, gauge their life. Am I going to have a home where my children are going to grow up in a good neighborhood with good schools, safe? Going to give me the opportunity to not only have this home base, but also, you know, to do other things. And that has been ripped away from so many people. And so many people are looking at that dream, that thing that they've been working their whole lives for, and going, you know, it's now getting further and further from my reach. And now, especially, you know, these folks who are in over their heads because the market collapsed. Because if you remember back when this was all ramping up, and I do, I was fortunate enough to have sold a house during the insanity, you know, where we put it up for sale at one price. And we end up getting, like $35,000 more than I asked for it. Because people were just, it was just, the market was crazy. And you had people coming out saying, wow, you know, this is going to keep up. And that upward trajectory, people thought, not going to stop. We're going to be able to plan on this. And I go back to what I said about my banker, the banker listener who laid it out for me. They thought that projection of upward profitability was never going to stop. You want to talk about drunk with desire, drunk with ideals, right there, man. So they thought, yeah, buy this house at $100,000. In 5 years, it'll be worth $150,000. I won't have to pay any principal. I can flip it, and ended up getting a cool $50,000 for nothing. And that's the mentality of some. And they're the ones who, you know, really, the buy 'em and flip it people. If you remember, Trump was out there throwing the ideal out there, actually holding seminars on how to flip houses. Mr. I want to be president now. but you know, that's part of what happened. And it was viewed as, hey, it's a way to get rich quick. It's a way to line our pockets. So what ends up happening? You end up creating this massive bubble. You end up creating this environment where, you know, people who are trying to, you know, get their house and try and eke it out, they got screwed. And when it popped, they end up holding the bag. Because we were no longer looking at can they pay, we were projecting what the value of the house was going to be when the banks took it back. And it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, I believe, for a lot of these banks. And I truly believe there were some people who knew this was coming. Anyway. Some of the numbers in this, 49 states are in on it. The only one, of course, being Oklahoma, who evidently doesn't want to punish banks. Thought it was, you know, just too hard on them. You got Schneiderman from New York. You got Harris from California. Biden from Delaware, who have thrown in after not being thrilled with earlier versions of it. So I have a little hope that maybe there's some good stuff in it. $26 billion in the number, is the number. Only $5 billion, from what I've seen, is going to be direct cash payments. The other stuff is going to be, you know, write-downs, things are going to be able to write off. You and I are going to get stuck holding the bag for that. You can see that. The five big banks, the five people who are being held liable, Wells Fargo, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, and Ally Financial, and the big one, of course, Bank of America. They're going to be held as the, and they're the five. $2,000 each for homeowners who qualified for the direct cash. Now I understand you have to, there's a lot of technical stuff into that, but $2,000 doesn't seem to me to be an awful lot of money, especially when you're talking about people who got kicked out of their houses and really got screwed over. But $17 billion going towards reducing the principal of loans. So again, like I said, that's going to be money that you and I are going to pick up, because they're just going to write it off on they're going to take write downs, on the bottom line. But I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that this will move us in the right direction. I'm happy to hear that, you know, the robo signing stuff won't be there. I'm hoping those people are held accountable. I'm hoping there's language in that allows, well, to lock criminals up. But we shall see. I'm, again, like I said from the beginning, I'm not overly optimistic. When Scott Walker comes out in favor of it and banks are willing to sign it, you kind of got to wonder. Bad news for the post office. It looks like they've lost another $3.3 billion. The big headline, Postal Service bleeds another $3.3 billion. Takes you a while to get down to the real reason they lost so much money, $3.1 billion to pre-fund their retirement account. Now, understand, they're the only operation probably on the planet. I know no private industry, no private sector employer has to do this, but they have to fund their retirement for 75 years into the future. So conceivably, I mean, 75 years is a long time. I don't know that the woman who's delivering my mail today is going to live 75 years from now. But conceivably, they're being forced to pay the retirement of people that are going to work for them who aren't even born yet. That's the theory, I guess. And you look at this, and there are a couple of bills in Congress. There's one that Lieberman and a couple other people have put forth who are saying, you know what, refund the overages that they've paid in pensions. Give them that money back, let them operate, push that way. Let them operate like any for-profit private corporation. Unleash them. And then there are the Republicans, the Daryl Issas of the world, who have come out and said, nope, we need to break them up. We need to slash and burn. We need deep, deep, painful cuts. We need to close hundreds or thousands of post offices. We need to lay off 225 to 250,000 employees. We need pain and slash, and we need to lengthen service. So instead of next day or second day mail, it's going to take 4 or 5 days. And you look at this, and again, it takes me back to what I've always said about the Republicans. Anytime you put these conservatives into power, anytime you give them an elected office, they're going to work to destroy everything around them. Everything that is ours, everything that is the public's, everything that is the commons. They're going to destroy. And the goal here is to destroy the post office. If you can stop and think of what 4-day service would mean to the post office. If it took them 4 days to deliver a letter from Philadelphia to Harrisburg, or from Harrisburg to Cleveland, or it took 4 days, imagine how many people would no longer ever use the postal service again. And that's the plan. Oh, we're going to cut off Saturday delivery. Well, how many small businesses need that? That's the plan. The plan is to force people away to go. Well, to go to FedEx or to go to UPS. And I'm not against UPS. Good union company. Use UPS every chance I get. But the Postal Service, they want to destroy. And, you know, as I'm looking at this, what's kind of frightening is that the politicos are pushing it. And the righties and the megaphones of the mega rich are pushing it. And average everyday people are buying it. It's kind of scary. Because understand, the post office is for us. It's ours. Belongs to we the people. And it gets no tax dollars. You know, the righties have done a nice job of convincing us, well, you know, it's just another government agency that's inefficient. Yeah, one that for less than 50 cents takes my envelope that I stuff something in and delivers it to California in 3 days. Boy, that's inefficient. I don't know what I would do. I can get it there next day. I can get it there next day through the post office, too. It's going to cost me a ton of money. It's not going to be less than 50 cents. But for 50 cents, I can deliver a stamp. I can deliver it anywhere. And they want to destroy that because they want to profitize it. I'd say if you want to save the post office, if I were in Congress, I would propose a bill that says, you know what, we're not going to deliver to anywhere that's difficult to deliver to. We're going to only deliver to profitable places. But you want to see a lot of people in rural America losing their mind? Maybe then our conservative friends would say, maybe we need to save the post office. Absolutely amazing. Anyway, when we come back, I want to talk with Patrick Gallagher from the United Steelworkers. This thing with Cooper Tire is just ludicrous, and it's ridiculous, and it's stupid, it's anti-American, but it is what American business does. Quick break, right back after this. There will be sorrow. fellow working class heroes, I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Thursday, February 9th, Mars is less than 1 month away from its March 3rd opposition, when it'll be at its best for this two-year period. Let the moon show you Mars tonight.
On the night of February 9th, 2012, the moon, planet Mars, and the constellation Leo the Lion are seen together over the eastern horizon about 2 to 3 hours after sunset. Regulus, Leo's brightest star, rises first at nightfall or early evening. Then the Moon and Mars follow some 60 to 90 minutes later.
The fainter stars of Leo might be hard to make out in the lunar glare tonight, but Regulus is Leo's brightest star and one of the brightest stars in our night sky. It'll be easy to spot. Mars beams even more brilliantly than Regulus. You can find Mars now near Denebola, the star that depicts the lion's tail.
Mars is a planet and moves in front of the background of stars. It makes a beeline around the entire sky through all the constellations of the zodiac every 2 years.
Leo's stars, like all stars, are much more steadfast. They rise 4 minutes earlier each day, or 2 hours earlier with each passing month. In March 2012, watch for Mars in front of Leo as soon as darkness falls.
We have lots more on Mars at the Tonight page at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Your proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come on, you good workers, good news to you out there.
This is one of those situations, and it's clear, which side are you going to be on? You're going to be on the side of the multinational corporation who wants to move manufacturing abroad, or are you going to be on the side of domestic workers? And the Obama administration decided, you know what, I better be on the side of domestic workers. The United Steelworkers built a case, a trade case against the Chinese for dumping. They were dumping tires here into the U.S., damaging our industry. And the steelworkers took the case. The Obama administration took it into the WTO, and, well, hey, we won. So they put some tariffs on. Jobs came back. Workers here began to be employed. Community started to see the benefit. Company not very happy. So as I understand it, they locked out their workers, and they are out as we speak. And as of Tuesday, I understand talks have broken down, which is why I've asked Patrick Gallagher, District 4 and District 1 spokesman for bargaining for the U.S. steelworkers. Patrick, thanks for taking time for me.
Good afternoon, Rick.
So where are we? Where do we stand right now? Where are things with bargaining right now?
Well, right now we're waiting. Hopefully we can get out of some more meetings with the company. We've always been willing to meet and talk and trying to reach a fair and reasonable agreement with them. They've kind of stalled out negotiations on us. We've got a sister plant in Texarkana, Arkansas, which just reached agreement January 20th. They ratified that agreement. And Cooper Tire Rubber Company, they're offering us a lesser settlement offer than what they agreed to down at Texarkana, and we're a little bit disturbed about that.
That is disturbing. Let's walk back through this because, you know, what's most disturbing to me is we have a situation where a company moves to China, moves production somewhere else, be it any company, and then is forced to come back because, you know, it costs a little bit more because we've put up some tariffs to protect our industry. And it looks like to me from the outside that they're retaliating against you guys for the fact that they have to produce tires in this country.
Well, it's been a big problem with us. What the company did was they purchased a joint venture in China. And as part of the purchase agreement, they agreed not to sell any tires in China for 5 years. So Actually, all those tires were meant for export. Most of them were targeted for the good old USA. We filed our 421 case for light truck and passenger tires because the Chinese were illegally dumping them there. Cooper Tire and Rubber Company did not go along with us on the 421. Goodyear, Firestone, some other companies all supported us and filed with us on this action. Cooper would not, and we believe the reason was because they wanted to bring all those tires in from China.
Now, I understand they're a very profitable company, no?
Yes, Dave. Since, well, last time in negotiations, let me set the table here a little bit. In 2008, the company was having some financial difficulties. You know, they came to us, and we agreed to a concessionary agreement, concessions of $31.2 million. After that, since January of 2009, the company's made $448 million in operating profit. And they came to us in the round of bargaining in the fall of last year, and they wanted more or less a concessionary contract. They wanted to change the piecework rate and the way our members were paid. Even though they made all this money, they had bought the other half of the joint venture they had in China. They also bought themselves a corporate jet. The management people all received 2-3% wage increases. They've also received double bonuses during the period when the company turned the corner profitable. We thought it was going to be our turn at the table, and the company turned around and really surprised us.
Yeah, but here's the thing. You've got to empathize with them a little bit, no? I mean, every company needs a new corporate jet, don't they?
No. I don't mind them having a corporate jet as long as they pay my members and the hard workers who made those profits for them a fair and reasonable salary. Give them a little bit of wage increase to put up with the inflation. Look what's happened to the price of gas. Look what's happened to the price of food. Everything's going up a little bit on the worker, and now we got to sit there and they want to take money away, and it's a profitable company. It's just not right. It's the epitome of corporate greed.
I'm right there with you, Patrick. I look at this, and we've been seeing a lot of companies around the country and internationally who are locking their employees out because they can. Everyone talks about strikes and everyone, the union's going to go on strike. That really hasn't been the case. What's been happening is you've been seeing companies locking their people up, basically kicking them to the curb. And, there was a case in Canada where they actually threatened their workers to where if you don't accept this contract, a 55% pay cut, we're going to move to the United States.
Well, that's what we're facing right now. If you look in the globe, Western European companies are looking at the United States for lower labor costs. They're moving some of their operations over here. I mean, BMW, Mercedes-Benz are examples. They're moving production over the United States because our labor laws are so weak compared to the strong labor laws that they have in Western Europe. And so we're now a low-cost labor company, a country.
The more I see this, and the more I hear the right wing in this country pursuing their no rights at work agenda, the angrier I get. Because look, at the end of the day, if we're not making a decent living, we can't buy their products. If we're not sharing in the wealth, this is going to be a country of haves, and the rest of us.
Well, I mean, if you look at history, you look at the greatest period of prosperity in the United States. It was at the time when unions represented 35% of the workers in this country, and I think that's where we need to get back to turn this country around.
But it comes down to having the conversation of explaining what unions are and what they do instead of what the right has thrown out there. And I say completely wrongly, but it's a conversation that has to be had.
This situation with Cooper Tire is a perfect example. When the company was in trouble, when a company did need some assistance, the union was responsible. We went out and we agreed to a concessionary contract. We went there and did this. Now that they became profitable, turned the corner, paid their management people, paid their salary people, which we don't begrudge them their raises. All we want is our fair share of the pie.
Yep.
What does Cooper do? They come out and they try to get more from us. It's corporate greed out and out, and it's led to the downfall of, I believe, put our economy in the situation that it is today.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. You look at this, though. They locked you out. Was there any Any discussion on working through, you know, saying, look, while we negotiate, our members want to keep working, because I find it amazing that companies just end up locking their workers out when the workers are willing to continue to sit and bargain and in good faith.
Right. Our contract expired October 31st. It did lock us out until November 28th. But prior to the expiration of the contract on the 31st of October, the company's North American president came in and told us that there would be no contract extension, that they would, you know, would work under the conditions of the old contract. There would be no dues checked off. There would be no binding arbitration. Tried more or less like to try to intimidate us into, you know, taking a lesser agreement. We didn't fall for that. We continued to try to bargain after the 31st. Finally, the company determined they gave us a last best and final offer. We took that back. The membership, rejected that 605 to 306, and we voted on a Sunday, and the following Monday they locked us out.
What can we do? What are you doing right now? What can we do to help? What's going on right now?
We're starting a corporate campaign. We've had some national days of action. We had one on February 14th where we hit 165 retailers of Cooper Tire across the country. We'll have another one on February 25th. Should be some publicity out and some mobilization through the AFL-CIO and also through the steelworkers, so listeners can try to contact them and see where the sites will be. We're also getting together with the Bakers Union, that's involved in the America Crystal Sugar Lockout. We're having a journey to justice. It's going to start up in Fargo, North Dakota, where America Crystal Sugar is located. We're going to have four members from the Finley bargaining unit on this tour. They're going to stop at stops across the country and explain what corporate America is doing to workers all across and trying to elicit support and get some help and get us to stop this abuse of corporate power and of corporate greed.
And that's exactly what it is. It seems that our labor laws are so badly broken that all the power lays in the hands of corporate America. And, you know, it's amazing to me. You hear the righties going on and on and about the NLRB and how, they're the pandering to big unions. You look at the laws, they're horribly broken.
Yes, they are. We need major labor law reform here to balance the scales. I mean, we need to have a strong labor movement. There's only two entities, that exist that can have any kind of counterbalance to the power of corporations, and that's the government and the union. And if we don't have labor law that protects labor unions and give workers a voice, we're going to end up being a third world country.
And that's, sadly for, you look at the poverty numbers of this country and the mass inequality, we are quickly heading in that direction. Patrick Gallagher, I appreciate the time. If there's anything we can do to help, let us know. We appreciate your time.
Appreciate the opportunity to talk to the listeners.
Thanks so much.
Keep up the good work.
Thanks so much. Patrick Gallagher, District 4 Director of District 1 of the U.S. Steelworkers. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around.
Leaders for involvement, 3,000 people screaming out,
where's our government?
Lawsuits and arraignments, members under company surveillance, public divided, either they love us or they hate us. Billions off our back, and it's still not enough. They should have taken to account
that we never give up.
We'll be here one day longer. The people's voice is stronger.
The people's voice is stronger.
We heard hard for our money, we will talk with respect. Keep fighting for these rights, the generations that's next.
One day longer.
Your working class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
It is believed that a little hard work is good for the soul. If this is true, then the history of child workers in the United States is a soulful tale. The first child laborers landed in Virginia in the year 1619. These immigrant children found slave working conditions and poverty wages in the New World. As the years passed, little changed. The average child worker toiled 16 to 18 hours per day, 6 days a week in factories and textile mills. Education was a luxury, and many believed a loss on working children. Charles Harding, president of the Merchants Woolen Company, stated,
There is such a thing as too much education for working people sometimes. I have seen cases where young people are spoiled for labor by too much refinement. Labor unions, consumer groups, and parent coalitions all work to shorten hours, ease conditions, and ultimately end exploitative child abuses. Baby strikes in Paterson, New Jersey, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, demanding 11 and 12-hour workdays were fought vehemently by mill and factory owners. The Pennsylvania legislature was the first to consider prohibiting child workers in 1833, and consider is all Pennsylvania did until July of 1903, when Mother Jones led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, in an attempt to influence President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1836, Massachusetts was the first state to pass a law restricting the use of children in manufacturing. And 102 years later, the United States Supreme Court ruled the Walsh-Healy Act restricting the use of child labor as constitutional. Also in 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put more stringent restrictions on the use of child labor. While hard work teaches discipline, self-reliance, and responsibility, the exploitive nature of our past must remind us that what we have today, we mustn't take for granted, for the days of tomorrow are doomed to repeat if we ignore those lessons hard learned. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, rick@therickSmithShow.com, or give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. I'm looking at the story today. The federal judge said, you know what? You're going to have to use the 2001 district maps. Basically, the Republicans wanted to throw out the 2001 maps. Since the 2011 ones got tossed, they're saying, no, not going to happen. You're going to have to use those. Because if you look at the delays that would come about, it would probably pretty much end the primaries. Could disenfranchise all kinds of voters. There's a lot of things going in the direction of getting petitions and all of that out. So I think this is the right thing to do. Could you make an argument that the 2001 map was a bad map based on the 2011 argument? Maybe. But that's done. We've dealt with that problem. Now we need to move forward. And hopefully what springs out of this whole redistricting debacle is a better way of doing this, a non-political way of doing it. You know, personally, there's got to be a computer model. There's got to be something that a committee that's non-political that can do this instead of drawing these really weird shapes that even the people who did the Rorschach tests would be embarrassed to come out with. But you know, hey, good news. So we will have a primary on April 24th. So that's good news. You remember the Hoekstra ad? I played it the other day for you. Well, this one.
Thank you, Michigan Senator Debbie Spend It Now. Debbie spends so much American money, you borrow more and more from us. Your economy gets very weak. Ours get very good. We take your jobs. Thank you, Debbie Spend It Now.
I think this race for U.S. Senate is between Debbie Spend It Now and Pete Spend It Not. I'm Pete Spend It Not Hoekstra, and I approve this message.
Now, he approves that message. Well, the Michigan Republican Party, their chairman, a guy named Bobby Shattuck, he has come out and said, well, you know, he's a good guy, and I take him at his word that he's not a racist because I know him well enough to be comfortable he's a man of integrity and he's got high values, family values, personal values, the way he lives his life. He says that the ad was created by an ad agency in a satirical fashion. It was satire. So by
by, you know, having this Chinese-looking girl ride up on a bike with rice patties in the background. That was just satire. He was just being funny. Don't you like it? He was just being funny. That's all. Just a little humor. You can't take a joke? Can't take a joke? Guess not. What it says for me, though, and you listen to the rationale, he is Pete Spend It Not, which tells me that Pete is going to be a guy who's not going to invest in infrastructure, a guy who's not going to invest in education, a guy who's not going to invest in health care or any of the things that we as a society want, need, and demand. And you look at John Boehner now coming out saying, well, you know, I don't know if we're going to be able to pass that $260 billion transportation bill. Gee, not, ooh, gee, I don't know. Will it? Hope so. Maybe, quite possibly. But that's not up to me, he says. It's up to the House. He was talking today at the CPAC conference. And you look at this and you go, exactly, explain to me why we can't get this pushed through. Why can't we get what I'm saying is a massive jobs bill through? Well, obviously, it's political. They don't want this president to have a win. And look, you know, the money that they're putting out, I don't think is near enough. And I said this earlier in the week. The Association of Civil Engineers, they've come out and said, look, we need $262 billion each and every year for the next 10 years. $262 billion per year, every year. We have a $3 trillion problem. Our infrastructure is crumbling. They're talking about passing for 5 years $260 billion. And that's a good thing, I guess, according to them, which is more than the Senate bill. And I look at this and I go, well, why? Because we're worried about not raising taxes. We're worried about spending not. I mean, think about what went into that ad. What the concept was. One, you want to hit her before benefiting the Chinese, because all of the money we're borrowing from the Chinese, which again is a conversation all of it in of itself. The fact that we don't manufacture enough in this country, and the fact that we're buying so many things overseas, and the fact that we're allowing our multinationals to set up camp over there. You go back to the guy we just talked to about Cooper Tires. They agreed not to sell a single tire in the country for 5 years. Where do you think they were going to sell those tires? Well, here. So, of course, they cut production back here. They dump all of those tires into here. But, Rick, the consumer benefits. Well, what benefit is it to the consumer if they don't have a job? Explain that to me. Because if you're not taking some raw material, turning it into some value-added product that people are going to use, I'm sorry, you don't really have an economy. You know, this idea of, I'll wash your dog and you'll cut my grass ain't cutting it. Because those are low-paying jobs. There's no value being added to them. So by having these trade deals, I mean, to me, you want to talk about the problem? The problem is our trade deficit. The massive trade deficit. Now, if Pete Hoekstra came out and said, you know what, I'll be the first one to say we need to balance our trade budget, our trade deficit, I'd be okay with that. Okay, Pete. Instead of Pete Spend It Not, how about Pete Balance Trade Now? But Pete's not running on that because the multinationals don't like that. So I look at this transportation bill, $260 billion over 5 years. As I'm looking at it, you're talking about 20% of what the civil engineers say is necessary. So it's telling me we're going to be throwing money out to keep falling behind. So the less we invest, the longer we wait, the more we lose our opportunity, the more that window closes shut, and the more that the Chinese, well, they benefit. Because companies keep going, well, gee, you don't have the infrastructure. Gee, you know, you can't service our needs. One of the things Corbett brought up in his budget, the dredging issue. Not that the people in New Jersey are going to be thrilled with it. Don't even know if we'd get the ability to do it. But he said, yeah, let's do that. Let's invest. Yeah, where are you going to get the money? Where are you going to get the money for that? You get it from the federal government? Where Pete, spend it not? Well, I'm looking down in South Carolina. Senator Lindsey Graham yesterday was all a Twitter that the U.S. Corps of Army Engineers, they have allocated some $2.5 million to study the idea of doing what? Oh, yeah. Deepening the port in Charleston, South Carolina. So that, and why are they doing it? Well, to accommodate the next generation of super tanker. Did anybody watch the budget discussion yesterday with, or the other day with Governor Corbett? Anybody? That's one of his ideas. We need to get those super tankers into port. They're doing it too. And where's that money going to come from? Pete, spend it not? I don't know. But Lindsey Graham gets it. He says, look, one out of five jobs in the state of South Carolina are tied directly or indirectly to the operation of that port. And he says, look, you know, if we can invest, we can make that deeper, we can create jobs in the state and more jobs for the future. Now, that's Corbett's plan. So what we've got is we've got, now we're going to compete against South Carolina to see who's going to pick up the tab. Will it be the taxpayers of the state of Pennsylvania or the taxpayers of the state of South Carolina? Because evidently our federal government can't make that decision. Because what should happen is we should have an overall plan to where we help everybody. And this is where Lindsey Graham knows his Republican buddies are going to be able to move some things around, push a little bit, and he may get that. So there's a lot to this stuff. And, you know, one of the guys who was quoted in this article, I think he's the head of the South Carolina Port Authority, a guy named Bill Stern. He said that, you know, it's wonderful news for 260,000 South Carolinians whose jobs depend on the competitiveness of the port. He said the nation needs a true 50-foot deep harbor in the southeast region because of growing trade. He says, look, you know, we're getting bigger and bigger ships, bigger and bigger demand. Now they go and say, well, there's a lot of manufacturing going on, and you're seeing it shipped out. I'm a big fan of saying, okay, let's dredge out that. Let's make it popular for bigger ships to come in. There'll be jobs created, but also manufacturing. See, they understand that they do this, it's going to create jobs. It's called, there's an I word. And maybe somebody call Apple. Because maybe, dig up Steve Jobs, maybe someone could put this out. The iVest. The invest. You know, something. Figure out something how to make this to where we actually start thinking again about investing in our infrastructure, investing in the nation, so that we're creating jobs, creating opportunity. We used to do this. It was a long time ago. I'm sure most people, it's before their times, but we used to. Ah, the good old days. They're saying that the project to deepen the channel there would cost about $300 million to do. About $300 million. And you go, okay, why aren't we doing it? It's a good question. Because we've got Pete, spend it not, Hoekstra running around saying, well, we can't spend any money. We need to give it to the millionaires and billionaires. We need to make sure that the multinationals are not paying their taxes. And you look at the lost opportunities we have here in the state. There's so much money that's been left on the table. And this impact fee thing they passed yesterday, a sham? Ripoff? Give me a break. Weak? Pathetic? Ridiculous? Yeah. All of that. Quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The IBEW Local 1464 organizing win at a GE transportation plant in Kansas City, Missouri, the first at a GE plant in 10 years, was officially certified this week. GE mounted a strong anti-union campaign through its union avoidance operation, but IBEW lead organizer Mike Knox says workers at the plant got fed up with broken management promises and wanted union representation. He says this organizing win for the IBEW sends a powerful message.
It was a very big win. Our message is, you bring the IBEW in, you now have a seat at the table. Before, you take what the company gives you. Company doesn't give you a raise. Company changes your benefits. What do? You can't do anything. You have to take what the company gives you. You bring the IBEW in. Now you have a seat at the table. You have a say-so. You can vote on what goes in that contract.
A worker was killed at that plant in 2010. IBEW 1464 business manager Daryl McCubbins says despite a constant anti-union campaign by GE, the workers who rebuild railroad traction motors at the plant voted for the IBEW. McCubbins says safety was a huge issue, and he urges workers facing similar issues to contact local unions and get organized.
If you're in a place that you would like to see organized, contact a local in your area and sit down and get informed of what your rights are and start having conversations with other coworkers. I believe the labor movement is on the upswing, and we're still here. But we need help to get to the people to help organize them.
Republicans are not happy about having their National Labor Relations Board obstructionism trumped by President Obama. Jesse Russell has more.
Republicans spent Tuesday fretting that President Barack Obama's recess appointments to the National Labor Relations Board amounted to a constitutional crisis. Committee on Education and the Workforce Chairman John Klein of Minnesota argued that businesses will be unable to make important decisions because they aren't clear on the legitimacy of the appointments. Republicans had been opposed to approving the president's picks, leaving the board incomplete and in violation of the National Labor Relations Act. During a Tuesday hearing, Arizona Representative Raul Grijalva said an incomplete labor board was hurting working families.
Employers, not to mention the workers and their families, I don't think they benefit from a dysfunctional board that cannot make decisions. That to me is even routine, mundane decisions can't be made during this period. And that to me seems to be really bad public policy.
This newscast made possible in part by Ulico, the Union Labor Life Insurance Company. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So I'm looking at the budget and, you know, the priorities. You know, they say it's a moral document. They say it shows someone's values. And, you know, I look back at last January, back just a couple of weeks ago, the legislature, 193-0, declared 2012 as the year of the Bible. And I look at the priorities put out in the budget, and in the perspective of this is the year of the Bible, I'm not seeing that the two are, I don't see that they come together at all. Just not. Anyway, here to come talk about the budget and what's going on here in the state, I've got Jim Byrne. He is the chairman of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party. Jim, thanks for taking time for me.
Good afternoon, and thanks for the opportunity to be on the show.
So it's the year of the Bible, evidently. None of the years past or future are going to be the year. Today is it, yet we've got a governor whose priorities are cutting education, cutting health care, and basically cutting things that help the poor while enriching the very wealthy.
Well, if it's the year of the Bible, our friends on the other side of the aisle are reading out of the book of Revelation. and some of the more dire chapters contained there. And this is such a disconnect between working families, education. It's the second teaspoonful of bad medicine in 12 months. I mean, higher education hit the worst. Program cuts and tuition increases for Pennsylvania students. I mean, look what the Philly Inquirer said. Rick, higher education appears to be taking the biggest hit, with funding being axed for three of the four state-related universities.
Yep.
Temple, look at Temple, $98 million, down from nearly 140, 30%. Penn State, 163 from 227, 28%. Pitt, from 136 to 95, 30%. Lincoln stays about the same, but you know, here we go. Going after one or two line items in the budget that are as critical to the future of this nation and its next generation as anything else.
Yeah, I've taken that position. This is the second budget in a row where we have not invested. His statement on transportation was extremely distressing to me. This notion, well, it took us several decades to get here. Basically, we're not going to solve it overnight. So let's talk about it in the maybe next year.
Exactly. Kick it down the road. It's a crisis. There will be an economic ripple effect if it goes under. The infrastructure, he doesn't pay much attention to that, especially out here in the West. Bridges, roads, are at a critical level with respect to public safety. Let's kick the can down the road there as well. He's thinking like a former prosecutor. You cannot think in terms of absolutes. You cannot look at one or two things at the exclusion of others and at the peril of others. Two-dimensional thinking at its worst for most families. And a lot of folks out there who are his donors and his sponsors and folks he apparently seems to be protecting, they drive on these roads and bridges, too. We needed our own Marshall Plan, especially in Western Pennsylvania, since the Marshall Plan. We're not seeing it in this budget, a complete disconnect.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Even when you look at the fact that his own advisory panel said we need about $2.7 billion in infrastructure and transportation spending, he's chosen, well, none.
Right. I don't understand why there's such a complete disregard, even for his own advisors. If it's $2.7 billion, you have to start somewhere. You have to start fixing them, even if you got to do it in increments. That's fine. We all know that we're in a crunch here. Let's go to the ones that have been determined to be the most critical or unsafe or the ones that have been closed. And let's start there and start from the worst and move forward, you know, one step at a time. Look, they didn't decay in the last two or three years, and they're not going to be fixed in the next two or three. But start the process and find the resources to get it done.
Absolutely.
Not happening here.
Absolutely. And I look at his idea for education, which is probably the most distressing to me. This idea that we're going to have block grants. Somehow education and the general welfare budget we're going to do on block grants. And, you know, I go back to the 90s. I saw that movie. It failed.
Right. Right.
And this is his new innovation?
Maybe. No, I speculate that it's an attempt, a very weak attempt, to appease those of us who advocate for the importance and critical need for higher education in this state, that perhaps we'll see that as allowing us to get by, or as that's a little sugar to help the medicine go down, but it insults the intelligence of those who understand the program, know that it is nothing but a failure. It will not solve these problems. It's actually insulting, quite frankly.
No, I mean, the whole budget is insulting. When you take it in the context of how much money we're leaving on the table, how much revenue we're leaving on the table, when you look at the fact that the pathetic impact fee they just passed on the natural gas drillers, the fact that the Delaware loophole is still wide open, so many revenue streams that we are not tapping, that we should be, that would not affect middle-class working people in this state at all, he's left on the table.
He absolutely has. These are no-brainers. It's about priorities. These very simple decisions, which are not controversial, Rick. I mean, we're talking about closing a loophole that doesn't hurt Pennsylvania families. It helps them. We're talking about a real drilling fee, not a sham that just came through. And I know that Terzi was really trying to cut some deals there. I mean, we're talking about a real impact fee, Rick, one that is comparable and consistent and within parameters already established in other states that have this resource. Things that help Pennsylvanians, I mean, it's not as if there would be controversy or outcry or backlash, things that people want this governor to do.
Yep.
But his cost benefit is to select and help the privileged few at the expense of all the rest of us. And it's so unfortunate for Pennsylvania right now.
Yeah, I look at his statement last year that he wanted to be like Texas. I agree. Let's be like Texas. They've got a pretty decent severance tax, a pretty decent extraction tax down there, as I understand it. Why don't we do that?
Sure. And even folks like Governor Palin, who one out of a million, I'll agree with her, that she does the same thing or did the same thing in Alaska.
The good socialist governor, sure. What I've been saying is there's something really wrong when you're looking at Pennsylvania being the reason that potentially a state like West Virginia is going to have a lower standard of living. We're actually pulling West Virginia down by having a lower tax than they do.
I agree. And I know that there's some back channeling. There is division in the ranks on the Republican side of things on this issue. But there's just not enough momentum over there to stand up to the governor right now and push back and come to some bipartisan solutions and get past these issues for the benefit of all Pennsylvanians. It's a shame when a leader doesn't lead by consensus building and inclusion, but just tries to come in with a hammer and point their finger in people's faces and say, because I said so. Because right. I said so doesn't work.
Yeah.
Well, and he's going to learn that over time.
And, he keeps talking about tough choices. Tough choices for who? The only people I see being affected by this are people who don't have a voice to stand up and fight back. How tough is that?
Maybe they're tough choices for him because he doesn't want to compromise the donor base to put him in the office. But they're not. They're no-brainers, and they're right over the plate for the rest of us if he were to be doing the right thing.
Yeah, I mean, I would say break your little pledge. Stop making Grover Norquist the most powerful guy in the state and do what's right. But, here again, this is where I keep saying people have to get to the polls. We've got the government we deserve because these are who we voted in. These are the people that we elected. And you know what? In November, we can throw them the hell out.
You're right, and that's what our party is working to do, rebuild the state party to be a central nervous system for those who have been disenfranchised, for Democrats in Pennsylvania to get the messaging, the talking points, and the information they need on why this governor and those who follow him are leading us the wrong way. And we're going to continue to work diligently to do that and to look for candidates. We just dodged a significant bullet with respect to this redistricting issue. I mean, the Republicans, Rick, spent millions in 2009 to capture the majority on the Supreme Court. And when we were out there across the state campaigning, warning folks of the potential consequences that could have when it came to redistricting, we did the best we could, but they got their candidate in. Fortunately for this state, what happened with the Supreme Court throwing out those ridiculous maps was a victory for democracy and a victory for the independence of the judicial branch. As much as they spent, they couldn't buy the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and, you look at this, and, going back to the 2001 redistricting, I mean, as I remember it, it was a Republican redistricting plan then as well, but just not nearly as bad as this one.
No, this one, I mean, when the Supreme Court sarcastically pokes fun at it in their decision, and again, the swing vote was Justice Castile. Kudos to this court for staying above the political fray.
Absolutely.
But when they're looking at maps drawn by private citizens on kitchen tables as being more within the parameters of constitutionality, that is a reaffirmation of what the Democratic Party said during this whole process. Our leaders were left out of the room. They threw these maps in at the last minute. They rubber stamped them, and they were so beyond the. And it's a one out of a thousand that the Supreme Court, irrespective of which party, would interfere with a map.
Yeah,
that's
was surprised.
How bad this map was.
Yeah, I was actually surprised. I thought we were going to live under this this tyrannical rule for 10 more years because, look, they drew the map. Is it any surprise that when they had the power, they drew it to benefit themselves? And the answer is no. So the question then becomes, how do we get it out of the political hands to where it's done in a more fair, honest, and above boards way?
Well, that's one thing that I completely agree with. Because I would be saying this. People say, "Oh, sure, you're saying this, Jim, because your party is not in control of the House or the Harrisburg right now." No, I would say it again in 2 years, if the Democrats were in control. You need somehow to pull the politics out of this. And we've an issue now in Allegheny County with redistricting for the county council seats. Some folks have put some good maps together, Democrat and Republican alike. At the end of the day, we hope down here to lead by example, having some lines for our council seats that are about inclusion and access, irrespective of party lines. But we need an independent panel, folks outside of the political process who are empowered to do this when the time comes. The system is broken. I don't care who's in charge.
Yeah, I agree. Last two questions. One, is there a good shot you're going to take back part of the House? I mean, at some point, there's got to be some check and balance in our state government. I mean, the Republicans this past year have had steamroller power. Granted, they've been divided enough to shoot themselves in the foot. But I worry that if they ever get their act together, we could be Wisconsin or Ohio or some of the other states where some real ugliness has taken place.
I have to commend our leaders, Senator Costa, Frank Dermody in the House, Senator Costin, for the hard work that they're doing, finding great candidates who represent our values. It's not just our party's values, but mainstream Pennsylvania values to run for a variety of these seats in the Senate and in the House across the Commonwealth. We're going to work very closely with them, and we appreciate and celebrate that partnership to work hard to try to do what you just said, get those seats back, capture majorities if possible, and push back hard on this disconnected governor and his failed projections for this Commonwealth.
Last question I've got for you. Going to put you on the spot here because I personally think Bill DeWeese should be not in government. The conviction came down. He should have gone. I think Babette Joseph was right to ask for him to step aside. Have you taken a position on this, or is this something you think will work itself out?
Well, I've said the same thing. I said this early on, and I'll say it again. I've said this whenever there's been a Democrat or a Republican under the scrutiny of an investigation, and ultimately when there's been a verdict. Mr. DeWeese was had a presumption of innocence, and that presumption's now gone. I think it becomes too much of a distraction to Mr. DeWeese. It becomes difficult for the party and difficult for his constituents. With the inevitability of a sentencing hanging over him, I think Mr. DeWeese should do the selfless thing and not seek reelect. He should be allowed to serve as long as he's allowed to under the Constitution, but I don't think he should be having a conversation about running for election again. That should be off the table.
And constitutionally, what is he allowed to do? Because to be honest, just common sense to me is you were found guilty. Now, as you said, the presumption of innocence gone. You're guilty. Let's move on.
Well, the way I understand it, and I apologize if I'm misspeaking, but my understanding is that until sentencing, he's allowed to serve. And if sentencing's in 1 or 2 months, then you know he's within the parameters of the law, and he's entitled to all that entails. And if that means he can hold office until such time as he's sentenced, then that's his right.
All right.
But once he's sentenced, that's it. And as far as trying to get continuances or postpone the inevitable, or circulate petitions, I would say that that's harmful to himself, to our party, and to his constituents, and he should not do those things.
All right, Jim, I appreciate the time. Jim Byrne, chairman of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party. Don't be a stranger. We'd love to have you back.
I look forward to the next time to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Last year, during an intimate chat and shoe dinner with some Silicon Valley high-tech barons, President Barack Obama posed a question to Steve Jobs, Baron of the Apple Empire. What would it take to make iPhones in the United States? Good question. We need to put more people to work building more stuff in America rather than shipping all that manufacturing off to China. Instead of answering, however, Jobs just said, those jobs aren't coming back. Well, why not? Why shouldn't American corporations go all out to help meet the obvious economic needs of the nation that nurtures them? The high-techers don't mention the obvious reasons for their jobs dodge, raw corporate selfishness. Rather than looking inward, however, they blame America. First, they wail that American schools are failing to produce the high-skilled workers they need, so they must go abroad. Yet, these very executives constantly demand that governments exempt them from paying the taxes necessary to improve schools. Second, they say that the U.S. lacks an integrated supply chain, which would locate makers of assorted computer parts right next door to assembly plants. But wait, that's their fault. Apple, Dell, and the like have the market clout to entice suppliers to relocate anywhere in America. Indeed, U.S. suppliers say they've had to move to China because that's where Apple et al. Went. Finally, industry leaders blame us, their customers. They assert that we insist on getting a new cheap iGadget every year, no matter where it's made or how workers are treated, so we force them to abandon America. This is Jim Hightower saying, hogwash! These self-serving, over-pampered, high-tech elites can make iPhones and anything else right here in America. But they care more about their bottom lines than their country or their workers. And it's time for us to call them on it. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, Rick at therickSmithShow.com, or give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So the war on religion continues. Those evil, nasty, progressive, liberal, Planned Parenthood people. At least that's what I'm being told. I don't have a problem with people practicing their religion. I'm kind of of the Gandhi mind. You know, I like your Christ, just not your Christians. Decent dude, but the practicing falls a little short. So when I see Rick Santorum running around saying that Obama is trying to destroy faith in America, trying to crush our faith and take it away and marginalize faith and remove the pillars of God-given rights. He says, what's left? Well, the French Revolution. That's what's left. He says, you know, and basically what the whole idea is that Obama's marching us down the path of the French Revolution, and people are going to get their heads cut off. Because what's left in France became the guillotine, according to him. And that's where he says we're heading. And I look at this whole nonsensical discussion, and in a little bit, I guess I'm going to talk to somebody from who's at the CPAC convention, some guy named Klukowski. Ken Klukowski is his name, director of the Center for Religious Liberty. And I guess I'm going to ask him, hey, you know, where is your liberty being taken away? Because I'm not seeing it. As someone who considers myself a Christian, I don't see where my ability to practice whatever it is that I believe in is being hampered at all. Especially when you start talking about my health care, my access to service. All I see them trying to do is restrict my access so that somehow their rights are more important than my rights. And that's where we run into these problems. I don't want public money going to religious institutions. I don't. And in fact, the founders didn't want that. As I remember, one of the first vetoes of the Madison era, who was a preacher, was against using government money to give to churches to take care of the poor. Didn't want the perversion of religion with government. Didn't want them together. Wanted them separate, a clear wall of separation. But I look at this story, and Spike sent it to me this morning, up in Mount Pocono, where he pointed out, you've got this Shawnee Tabernacle Church, who evidently has taken more than $3 million in taxpayer money.
because evidently they own the building of this school. It's a nice scam. This is a and this is going to happen. This will be replicated by every right-wing religious operation across the state as we allow this to continue. They're going to build a building. They're going to say there's a we're having a good Christian church, a good school, and the state has to pay us $7,000-$8,000 per child. We'll just completely inundate those students with our message, but it's still a charter school. And they'll own the building, and they'll gouge our eyes out for rent. In fact, the rent for the charter school in the year of 2006-2007 was $396,000. That's what they charged for the rent. And that's what, you know, we, the taxpayers, paid them. In 2009-2010, it was almost $1 million. So I'm looking at this going, wow, more than double? 2.5 times? Really? Especially during a downturn? A major downturn where we could have gotten considerably cheaper rent elsewhere? In fact, the audit also shows, done by Auditor General Jack Wagner, that the church benefited from the use of $765,000 worth of items paid for by the school. The gym equipment, the bleachers, a new elevator, a parking lot expansion. We paid to expand a parking lot so they can get more people to go to their megachurch. But Rick, there's a war on religion. You're beating them up because they believe. No, I'm beating them up because they're thieves. And this is the direction that the radical right wants to take us. Look, I don't have I could care less what you believe or who you pray to or if you pray. Doesn't matter to me at all. I hope you do. I hope you have a set of values. I hope you have something that gets you through the day. All for it. But the second your belief structure infringes on my rights, then we got a problem. And nobody is forcing the radical right to do anything. Be it gay marriage, if you don't want to get married to a man or a woman, don't. I think that's pretty simple. I don't think that's radical. But if people that you don't know somewhere where you don't live or never see does, who cares? You know, my grandfather said, don't worry about me. Worry about yourself. Spend time worrying about you. Make yourself happy. Lead your own life. Don't worry about what everybody else is doing. But worry when it steps on your toes. And I see a lot of what the religious right in this country is doing is pursuing this agenda. This agenda to take from you and me to keep pushing their ideology. And I love the fact that they say, well, Rick, religion is under attack. There's a war on Christianity. There's a war on religion. And I go, yeah, when was the last time you saw a SWAT team bust into a church and beat people up because they were having church? Oh, you haven't. Oh, that's right, because it doesn't happen. When was the last time we threw somebody in jail? Oh, but we could. Oh, because Obama's evil. And, you know, I guess you could keep making those statements. I guess you can throw all that out there. And you can keep telling people who want to believe that their particular brand of faith is under attack. I'm not buying it. The rational people in this country realize they want to get up and go to church. They go to church. They want to follow a particular faith. They do. I'm just not seeing it. And hopefully when we talk to this guy, he'll enlighten me, because maybe he can sway me to his direction. And maybe hell can freeze over. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. And they're talking in the town square. In the tavern, they're shouting. Hell, talking everywhere. They're talking about the skies. But all their words of wisdom won't make you go away. The day they close the back to down and
your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Thursday, February 9th. Mars is less than 1 month away from its March 3rd opposition, when it'll be at its best for this two-year period. Let the moon show you Mars tonight.
On the night of February 9th, 2012, the moon, planet Mars, and the constellation Leo the Lion are seen together over the eastern horizon about 2 to 3 hours after sunset. Regulus, Leo's brightest star, rises first at nightfall or early evening. Then the Moon and Mars follow some 60 to 90 minutes later.
The fainter stars of Leo might be hard to make out in the lunar glare tonight, but Regulus is Leo's brightest star, and one of the brightest stars in our night sky. It'll be easy to spot. Mars beams even more brilliantly than Regulus. You can find Mars now near Denebola, the star that depicts the lion's tail.
Mars is a planet and moves in front of the background of stars. It makes a beeline around the entire sky through all the constellations of the zodiac every 2 years.
Leo's stars, like all stars, are much more steadfast. They rise 4 minutes earlier each day, or 2 hours earlier with each passing month. In March 2012, watch for Mars in front of Leo as soon as darkness falls.
We have lots more on Mars at the Tonight page at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. So finally, it looks like the state of Colorado is going to charge one of these glitter bombers. Someone decided they were going to throw glitter at Mitt Romney. And look, I'm no Mitt Romney fan, but I'm tired of this. Someone threw glitter on me, I'd punch him in the mouth. And the reality is I hope one of these candidates do. I would vote for him then, because it's ridiculous. You throw words at people, I'm okay with that. The second you start throwing glitter and flour and whatever else, not going there. So the first candidate, I don't care who it is, who pops one of these people in the mouth, you got my vote. Anyway, today is the big CPAC conference, the Conservative Political Action Committee's big conference there in Washington, D.C. And here to talk a little bit about it is Ken Klukowski. He is the director of the Center for Religious Liberty. He's also co-authored the book, The Blueprint, Obama's Plan to Subvert the Constitution and Build an Imperial Presidency. Ken, thanks for taking time for me.
Rick, thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
How's the grand conference going?
Well, I'll tell you, I think people are really energized. There's a lot going on, as you know and your listeners know. Regardless where people come down on the issues, everyone acknowledges there are big issues that are being hotly debated in the country right now. So I think everyone senses, Rick, and you sense the energy here in this regard, that everyone understands that one way or the other, 2012 is going to be a historic election.
Yeah, I'm hoping that at some point we start focusing on the issues that I think are really important. Get off the gay marriage, get off the contraception, get off of that nonsense. Start talking about how we get this country back to work, how we improve our national security, how we make sure that we are the country we like to tell ourselves we are.
Well, I'll tell you, certainly economic issues are of critical importance, so is national security. And then, again, for tens of millions more, those social issues are also critically important. So, obviously, there are people saying, you know, that they want to focus on one or two of those three categories. And you'll find here at CPAC, I think, and certainly where I come down, is you'll get people that are willing to fight on all three, believe that all three are inextricably linked in terms of the long-term prosperity and success of the country.
So why is Barack Obama the evil Satan? Why I've heard him painted as everything but a decent American, and in fact, well, painted as a non-American.
Well, I'll tell you, I've never called him evil. I've never called him Satan, and I've never called him non-American. I'm not even sure if that's an adjective or a noun. But the but I think what we do see with President Obama, and certainly what we talk about, not just in our first book, but yeah, also in our second book, Resurgent, How Constitutional Conservatism Can Save America, is we talk about how when we speak about an imperial presidency, Rick, we're talking about an imperial president is just a president exercising powers beyond the limits of what the Constitution places on it. And whether that is, you just referenced one in the social issues, whether that is issuing a regulation that requires religious institutions or religious business owners to violate their religious conscience, whether it's the economic issue of the individual mandate commanding people that they must buy a particular product when that's beyond the limits of what Article 1, Section 8 puts as the powers of the federal government, in whether it is starting a war in Libya, launching a war, wherever you draw the line on self-defense and a president's inherent powers and whatnot, where there is no national security interest and no treaty obligation, a president unilaterally ordering the U.S. military to start a bombing campaign on a sovereign country, whether it's good policy or bad policy, it's still not the president's call. Only Congress can authorize the president to do it. So I think that's an example, Rick, on all three, social, economic, and national security, of how President Obama has been acting as an imperial president.
And I'm sure you were making these arguments, especially about the war and the bombing during the Bush years.
Give me an example, please.
Well,
we
did bomb Iraq into...
Hang on a second, though, Rick. Congress passed a resolution authorizing the commander-in-chief to launch a war in Iraq. So that's not an imperial
president.
If Bush had done it without congressional approval, that would have been an imperial presidency.
Based on cherry-picked
Look, Rick, there is no cherry-picking in the Constitution. Article 1, Section 8 says that Congress has the power to declare war. Only Congress can do it. That's not cherry-picking. That's the rule of law.
All right. Well, we'll disagree a bit on that because I still think
that this is... I'm a constitutional lawyer. This country lives or dies every day on every topic by the rule of law. The president's powers are and what they're not.
So, again, let's talk about that for a second because, you know, it's interesting, this whole discussion about contraception, this whole argument about being forced to buy things. You know, I'm looking at this in a frame that I have certain rights too, and all I keep seeing is the religious right pushing their. Really, I'm not even quite sure how this contraception issue affects them all that much. If they don't want to take, if they hold on, if they don't want to take, hold on, hold on, hold on,
hold on.
Nobody is telling you have to take. Birth control pills. Nobody is telling you have to have your family take them. You're saying there has to be access for people. If I want to partake in that, if I want to do it, if my wife wants it, it should be available. It's pretty simple. So when your rights supersede my rights, we have a problem.
Yeah, that completely misframes the issue. My alma mater
is not the misframing of the issue.
No, it is, Rick. My alma mater is the University of Notre Dame. It's a Roman Catholic institution. It is a church-run and affiliated institution.
And it takes federal dollars.
Under Catholic, but this isn't tied. This isn't a spending clause exertion. There is nothing that says you lose federal funding if you don't do it. It is a Commerce Clause command. They're saying we have the authority under interstate commerce to dictate to you to do this. It has nothing to do with federal funding. They did not predicate it on the spending clause. See, that may be cherry-picking to you, but to those of us who practice law, that's called the Constitution. I mean, that is the rule of law. It violates Catholic doctrine to take contraceptions or to perform abortions. And yet, this is the federal government saying, we order you that you will carry health care plans that provide those services in violation of church teaching.
Okay, so if I take that logic that you just laid out for me, then there are really no laws that the Catholic Church has to abide by because it's somehow against their conscience.
Absolutely not. That's not true at all.
But that's the argument you're making. You can't choose one and not the other.
Oh, sure, absolutely. Okay. You cannot, the federal government cannot impose laws that violate the honestly held doctrines of a church and tell them that they have to violate their religious conscience. 99% of the laws on the books have nothing to do with religious conscience. So this isn't a prescription for anarchy. It's just saying, just like they could not say, the federal government could not issue a law telling Notre Dame that you must set up a mosque and lead prayers five times a day to Allah. That would violate their religious teaching.
But that's forcing them to do something. Nobody's forcing you to take birth control. They're forcing
you. It's not an issue of taking birth control.
It absolutely is. It's an issue of giving people who want it access to it.
No, that's not it at all, Rick. It's an issue of saying you must provide these services at no copay. That is to say, the university must pay for those services for anyone working there who wants to access them. It's not talking about what those persons will or will not do. It's saying to the university, you will provide this service and you will pay for it out of your own pocket.
So then, based on you know, as I'm hearing you talk about, because to me it's a labor issue. You know, the benefits that I get through my employer, it's a labor issue. So I'm assuming you're someone who'd want to take us back to the days of Lochner and liberty of contract.
Actually, no. I think the Lochner decision was wrongly decided, and the Supreme Court correctly rejected it in U.S. v. Caroline Products. Are you familiar with all those cases, Rick?
I am, kind of.
Okay, well, if you are familiar with my jurisprudence at all, you'd know I don't support the Lochner-era doctrine. Caroline Products was rightly described, as the Supreme Court later reaffirmed in Ferguson v. Scrupa and Williamson v. Lee Optical. So, I mean, we can talk about that for an hour, but I think you're looking at getting pretty deep in some legal weeds where I'm not sure. That takes a lot of years of study to really get into.
I appreciate that. Let's go back to the CPAC convention. What's going on over the next couple of days?
Well, I think you're looking at speakers here on all the hot issues that are out there, and again, issues where different people come down on different sides. And there are issues of taxation, of spending, of the courts, of foreign policy, of Israel, and, of course, marriage and abortion, these other things that we've mentioned, and, of course, one of the biggest issues that we're facing this election cycle, Obamacare, which is a case that I'm involved in as a lawyer at the Supreme Court.
So as someone of faith, you go back here in Pennsylvania, we've ruled this year as the year of the Bible, our legislature, 193-0. I said this is the year of the Bible. How do you do what the Bible says? How do we help the poor? How do we take care of the sick and the needy? How do you do that?
Well, there's a difference there in terms of Scripture in that regard gives moral imperatives to individuals, and that's a matter between them and God. Nowhere does Scripture say that it's the role of the state to do those things, and that really is the debate. I don't think there's anyone that you would find here. Maybe you'd find some extreme libertarian here, I don't know, but most people at this conference would be characterized as conservatives. And they'd readily say we should take care of the poor. It's just a question as to what policies and what role of government most effectively and efficiently does that, and does it consistent with the U.S. Constitution.
And I guess the question for me is, have we done it, and will we, given the way things have gone in the past. Ken, great talking with you. I appreciate the time, and I'd love to talk to you again.
Rick, it was a spirited debate. I had a good time. I hope we get the chance to talk again soon.
Anytime. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner era, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only
only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitative use of child labor was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. And looking at it, going back to the discussion I had with the guy, the reality is, this is, I think, common sense. If you're going to be an employer, to me it's an employment issue. You have to provide health insurance for people. That should be the law. It's not. You go back to the Nixon years, that's what they wanted. But here's, if you're working and you're buying something, because understand, if you're working for an employer who's providing health care, really you're buying it. It's your money, just in a different compensation way. So to say that, the Catholic Church hiring people shouldn't have to have this in there seems kind of ridiculous to me. And, the idea is that, to me, it's pretty simple. This idea, and that they're somehow under attack, even when they're in the majority most of the time, especially when you're talking about the righties, is the only thing that gets them riled up. So being completely under attack, being the ones that are the ones having something imposed on them or taken from them, seems to be the only thing that gets them riled. I'm of the mindset that what you're doing is you're actually taking from me. This idea that you're taking my ability to have access to this seems a bit, I don't know. Let's go to the phone lines. I got Max on line one. How you doing tonight, Max?
Pretty good. I was listening to you on Stitcher from Germany. Can't sleep.
No, great.
And just listened to you talk to this, what I considered a crazy person in his arguments. I have a critique for you.
Hit me.
In the future, can you not let these guys filibuster? It's quite boring to listen to them filibuster.
Well, here's the thing. The one thing that I hate, and you're right, I gave him too much time, but I hate when people are constantly cutting each other off. I was going to let him make his point, and I did let him go too long because he ran through a whole bunch of stuff, and to be honest, I should have stopped and gone after each one. So an excellent critique, but I hesitate. Being one of those people who cuts people off, I don't want to be like the right wingers in this country who every time someone says something, they're being cut off.
Okay, that's fair. I was also on a project in Australia, and they have a great TV show there. They allow people to have their say, but up front, they tell them, you have 1 minute, 1 minute and a half, and as soon as that minute and a half is done, your mic goes off. This means you can say whatever you want. But you're not going to monopolize the conversation. Because these guys, these right-wing guys, are very adept at that. They're practiced at it.
Yep.
But at the end of the day, to me, it's boring.
Yeah, and I appreciate that input, and I will take it into consideration. Because you're right. I probably should have cut him off sooner. But in at the end of this, where do you stand on this issue of contraception? I'm not sure how it is in Germany, but here.
I can tell you one thing. And here I speak German fluently, and I'm an American, as you can probably tell by the way I talk. They cannot believe over here that normal people, I'll call them normal people, would ever vote Republican. The idea of restricting contraception is ridiculous. I mean, it's not a debate.
And the labor issues, I know of, because we know people. In fact, the pastor of my church, her and her husband and her family are actually from Germany. They can't believe on labor issues how backwards we are in this nation.
What they tell me is they say things like, "What happened? You were so good. What happened?" It's almost an unbelievable, and they're our friends. So you can only imagine the people who aren't our friends, what they think about the whole thing.
You know what the Chinese think. They're going to suck us dry because we let them.
Yeah, well, being stupid is a way to lose money, and that's what we're doing at the moment on a lot of these things. But regarding contraception, I also grew up in the Catholic tradition, so, it's been stupid to me since I've been about 8 years old. And I also know the actual practicing Catholics when I was growing up. I'm 60 years old. And it was ignored.
Yeah. Well, I'm a broken Catholic myself. I grew up being beaten in the Catholic school for the first 7 years of my life. So.
Been there, done that. As I tell my friends, I escaped.
I was able to escape. They let me out the door. That was a good thing. Max, I appreciate the input. I'd love to have you call back again.
Okay.
Thanks so much. We used to have sane, rational thoughts, I think, especially on issues of society. And I go back to my statement on this. You know, nobody's forcing them to take the contraception. It just has to be offered as part of a plan. What's next? Once we allow them to, and chances are, understand, the Democrats are probably going to cave on this. Obama's probably going to cave on this. There's going to be some exemption, and they're going to win this again. Because, like Cheney said, Democrats cave. That's what they do. So I'm expecting that to come. But nobody is telling them that they have to take it. Like I said earlier, I go back to the 90s. When we were talking about people on welfare, and it was the righties, it was the conservatives who the God fearing conservatives who wanted to mandate that women who get any welfare or any help from the state had to have Norplant. So there's some real problems, and I don't remember the church being crazy out in the streets protesting against that. But again, for me, it's about blinding the issues. When we're talking about contraception, we're talking about abortion, we're talking about gay marriage, it's about blinding the issues. It's the shiny thing in the room. It's, hey, look over here, stupid, while I rob you blind, which is what's gone on. We have been robbed blind in this country. There has been a massive redistribution of wealth from people like me and people like you, folks who work for a living, punch a clock and bust their behinds, try and save a little bit. We've been robbed blind. You look at the governor's budget. That is a massive redistribution of wealth. When you're talking about kicking people off of health care, you're talking about 30% cut to higher education. You're talking about block grants for public schools. Why? So we can give more money to the for-profit charters? Really? Are we going down that road? And, like Max said, over in Germany, they think we're stupid. You know why we're stupid? Because we've been underfunding education. We're doing to education exactly what we did to our transportation systems. We're not raising taxes on rich people. Good for us. But you know what it's costing us? It's costing us an intelligent future generation. It's costing us the educational opportunities that aren't going to be there. It's costing us the infrastructural improvements that aren't going to be there. We're in trouble. We are absolutely in trouble in this country, and we better figure out how to dig that hole out. Because if we don't do it, and we don't do it now, we're in real big trouble. Let's quick go to the phones, get Andy on line one. How you doing tonight, Andy?
Hi, Rick. How you doing?
I got about six minutes yet.
Yeah, I know you got to get going. Hey, I heard your conversation with that fierce reactionary, and I just think it's abhorrent. The laws of the land allow contraceptive devices and abortion and so forth. And if the Catholic Church does not want to adhere and does not want to let its workers do that, then they should be taxed. I mean, they're getting a free ride in this country. not paying taxes. If they're going to take a political stance on issues that have been decided by we the people, hey, the Catholic religion is only 20% of the population of this country. This is absurd.
I'm right there with you.
Driving this issue.
I think all religions should have to pay taxes, but that's a whole other argument for another.
Well, they're all cults. That's another issue. They're all cults in my mind, anyway.
But anyway,
that's a whole
other issue. You bring up an excellent point, and that you know, look, at the end of the day, you know, why are their values better than mine?
Right. They're only 20% of our population. Why are they deciding it for the majority when we've already decided upon this issue?
Yeah, but here's the thing. I mean, if you go back and you look at what I've been saying for the last 6 years, they want to undo Griswold. And Griswold's an important decision in this country that legalized contraception. They didn't really the abortion thing's one thing. They want the big prize, which is Griswold.
Right. Well, it's not their country. It's our country. If they want to bring us back to medieval times, we're going to push back. And we're going to put them back into medieval times.
There you go.
That's all I got to say.
I appreciate it, Andy. Always great talking with you, brother.
All right. All right. Take care, Rick. Bye-bye.
Thanks. And you know what the whole thing is you know, what they want is, you know, they want cheap labor, man. It's all about how can we get the cheapest labor out there, how we can get people to work for pennies. You know, the abortion issue for them is not, well, for them it's a labor issue. You know, it's about, well, what did Tom DeLay have to say?
If we had those 40 million children that were killed over the last 30 years, we wouldn't need the illegal immigrants to fill the jobs that they are doing today.
No, that's it. It's all about cheap labor. And for me, every issue does come back to work. It comes back to my ability to support my family. It comes back down to rights for all of us. And I found it interesting, you know, he's going to lecture me on Lochner, and I really didn't want to get into an hour-long discussion on the Lochner era. He threw out a bunch of cases that were partially part of it, but the main decision, you know, he seemed to miss, which, you know, okay. When you're throwing out stuff off the top of your tongue to, you know, sound important, I'm okay with that. But at the end of the day, they want to take us back to those days, the good old days, to where you had no rights whatsoever. The only people who had rights were the overlords, were the masters, were the employers, taking us back to the days of liberty of contract. That's where they want us to go. And it's one of those things that frightens me on a number of levels, because I think right now we in this country are really close to allowing that to happen and ending up in a, to use the fascist word, where the corporations and the government, they work hand in hand. And how much are we seeing? Public-private partnerships, government-sponsored enterprise, massive tax handouts, companies who would make no profit if it weren't for all the handouts. They pay no taxes. And yet somehow, though, that evil welfare mother, somehow that evil Planned Parenthood, that's what's going to bring the country down? No. What's going to bring this country down is the inequality, the fact that people who bust their behinds can't make ends meet and have been kicked out into the streets. That's what it is. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickssmithshow.com, the best place to go to get the program. If you've got a smartphone, you can get the Stitcher app and take the program on the go. Today we talked with Heather Shoemaker. She's a community affairs manager with Planned Parenthood, the evil Planned Parenthood. Also talked to Julia Ramsey, political director for Action United, on the foreclosure settlement, which I still think is a bad idea. Feel a little bit better that Schneiderman's in on it and Biden and a couple others. But anytime the banks say, okay, we'll sign, and Scott Walker says, thumbs up, I got problems. We also talked with Jim Byrne, the Pennsylvania Democratic Party chairman, and Patrick Gallagher, spokesperson for the USW, United Steelworkers Union, on this Cooper Tire situation, which, again, another screw job for working people that in places like Germany would never happen. But hey, we're number one. Yeah. Have a great night. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickssmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. It's coming.